you know, General, that George Washington spent his boyhood not far from here? And it's just across that river down there that he's supposed to have thrown that silver dollar and cut down that cherry tree.
That may be so, Mr. Taylor, but it has an even greater significance for me. It's where I met my wife. And it's something these Yankees do not understand, will never understand. You see, these rivers and valleys and streams, fields, even towns, they're just markings on a map to those people in the war office in Washington. But to us, oh my goodness, they're birthplaces and burial grounds, they're battlefields where our ancestors fought, places where you and I, we learned to walk, to talk, and to pray, places where we made friendships and, oh yes, fell in love. And they're the incarnation of all our memories, Mr. Taylor, and all that we are.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Keith Alexander on the show. Of course, Keith is the co-host of the Political Cesspool podcast. He does that with regularly with James Edwards, like once a week, correct?
That's right. Every Saturday night.
And that show is, it's on the flagship station AM 1600 WMQM in Memphis, Tennessee.
That's right. We're on terrestrial radio and on the internet.
It's the Liberty News Radio Network, right?
That's it. That's correct. That's who sponsors us out of Spanish Fort, Utah.
Oh, okay. And, of course, shortwave, from what I understand. So, okay. Well, Keith, thanks for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure.
Now, you describe yourself as a Southern nationalist.
Well, yeah, and we're also paleoconservative.
Paleoconservative Southern nationalist. So you're like into the Edmund Burke, Russell Kirk type thing?
Well, basically, Pat Buchanan. That's who got both James and me interested enough to do a radio show, which gradually became a podcast as well.
Oh, okay, so Robert Taft, that wing of the party that kind of was purged in the 50s by Wilma Buckley?
Well, Robert Taft, on foreign policy, on domestic policy, not so much.
Yeah, well, he was in Ohio, yeah.
Right, yeah. He was an integrationist, although he certainly wasn't like Chuck Schumer or somebody like that.
No, no. there was an alliance of different people that comprise the paleocons, even some libertarians. People would apply, you know, thinkers like Murray Rothbard to that too, because of his take on foreign policy.
That's right.
Yeah, so there was sort of a motley crew who opposed the regime as it sort of congealed and took form in the post-war period. Southern nationalism in the South. What makes the South distinct as a region, as an identity? You know, there's a lot of states down there. As a Yankee, I just say you're all just one big blob, right? You're all just Southerners. Although I wasn't born in the North, I was born in the South geographically, but not in a southern, people usually think of as a southern city. Raised mostly in the North, although I now live in the former Confederacy. So, so Southern nationalism in the South. What's this all about?
Well, basically, the people that live in the South, the ethnic stock, the founding stock,
mm-hmm.
is the same people that are here today for the most part. You know, people of Scots-Irish descent,
mm-hmm.
as well as English descent, some German descent. But unlike, let's say, New England or the Middle Atlantic states, other places like that, we haven't been swept by wave after wave of foreign immigration. The way that, let's say, New York has, or Philadelphia has, or even Cleveland, places like that. We are basically the same people we were back in the 19th century, blacks and white Southerners from the margins of England. See, in England, they have a little bit of a different dynamic socially than we have in America. In America, if you're from the North, you're a sophisticate, and if you're from the South, you're a hick, supposedly. Well, in England, I know this because I have an English mother. My mother was a war bride. She married my father, who was a sergeant in Patton's army.
Oh, so he was over there. What's the term? Over there, oversex, and overpaid, or something?
that's what the Tommies didn't like. Yeah. The guys dating British girls.
Yeah.
So they're the ones that made that up, that the GIs were overpaid, oversexed, and over here. And my father told me that the GI reply was that the English Tommies were underpaid, undersexed, and under Eisenhower.
So he brought her back.
He brought her back.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was getting to was that in England, they have a little bit different dynamic. It's based on your proximity to London. The nearer you are, or that your origins are from London, the more of a sophisticate you are. And the further away from London you are, the more of a hick you are. And the South was from the margins. We were from places like Devon and Cornwall, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, the Isle of Man, places like that, where the Puritan New Englanders, for example, were primarily from East Anglia, which is near London. My mother was from near London. She was from Hertfordshire. She grew up in Watford, England. And see, Hertfordshire is one of what they call the quote-unquote home counties. That's like suburban London, okay? But nonetheless, people in the South were people that, you know, that the English from around London have a, you know, they basically have a class system that almost qualifies as a caste system over there. They can tell where you hail from, you know, within a few blocks, basically, particularly in London. And like I tell people, they still have it. The English have had now a black American soft porn actress as a princess, but to this date, they've never had a Cockney princess. So basically, you know, we're the people that they look down their long noses at here in the South, but we were also the best pioneers. The Scots-Irish in particular were from Lowland Scotland, and they had a history of having enemy armies traversing their land, either the Highland armies coming down from the north or the English armies coming from the south. And that experience is what made them excellent frontiersmen, because they always had these armies passing nearby, and armies had stragglers. And these stragglers would wander up to your farm and pretend like they were totally innocent. If they didn't see any armed men around, then they'd fall to raping, pillaging, and murdering. And they found out when they came to America that this is exactly the tactics of a band of Indian braves. They would do the same thing. And The Scots-Irish learned from their experience that the men would take their weapons to the field with them. They had a sixth sense of, well, things are a little bit too quiet. Maybe I need to go up to the farmhouse and see what's going on. And, for example, I was born in Minnesota. Minnesota had basically Germans and Scandinavians. The Scandinavians were recruited to come over there because they could stand the harsh winters up there. And the problem with the Scandinavians were they weren't used to having enemies traverse their land. Plus, they had blonde hair, which made their scalps very valuable on the Sioux, war belts. So they were being decimated by the Sioux. But see, the Scots-Irish, on the other hand, all the people like Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, whatnot, basically Scots-Irish descent, although Davy Crockett was also French Huguenot descent. That Crockett is a French Huguenot name. But that's what we're the pioneers. And also, if you'll notice that in old Westerns from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and whatnot, most of the cowboys, as they're portrayed, have Southern accents. Like, for example, in the movie Shane, which I think is the best Western of all time, they have Southern accents. The reason they have Southern accents is a lot of Southerners dispersed into the West to get away from the persecutions of Reconstruction. In fact, it's said that the interior West is basically the South without a race problem. So, you know, that's my shorthand version of what makes the South unique and differentiates us from certain other parts of the nation.
Now, of course, the South itself, obviously different region, different culture, different economy, contributed, of course, to the what's called the American Civil War, the war to prevent Southern independence or secession, the war between the states, however you want to refer to it. The secession movement itself, the attempt to secede, I guess you're an advocate of such a right.
I think that it was obviously intended by the founding fathers, who were, for the most part, all the intellectual giants among the founding fathers tended to be Southerners. James Madison, Patrick Henry, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, you know, all of them. You had a few from other parts of the country that were significant, like John Jay and John Adams. But basically, the brain trust that came up with the both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were Southerners. And they are, you know, that's why, for example, Jewish power and influence is not particularly fond of the founding of this nation, because none of the founding fathers were Jewish. So they assume that they must be inferior.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting that although people are fairly familiar with, you know, generally speaking, with history, is the South declares its independence or secession from the North in 1861, right after the election of Abraham Lincoln. Now, of course, the first secession crisis in the United States was not in the South. It was indeed in the North, Hartford Convention. And this involved, I guess, dissatisfaction with what they called Mr. Madison's War, the War of 1812. And the northern states, rather, weren't happy with the fact that the U.S. government had kind of provoked this war with Great Britain, ostensibly over some navigation issues, the impressment of sailors. And so in 1814, I believe it's called the Hartford Convention, I think even Massachusetts even failed to mobilize its militia to take part in the war and kept trading with Great Britain during that war. That's right. Just how independent the states were. But the idea was the first secession crisis indeed was in the North, and they voted not to secede, but they, from what I understand, they did proclaim the principle of secession. And that was of all places, Massachusetts, I believe, or you know, the New England states.
Well, all of this suddenly discovered opposition to secession and trying to claim that the founding fathers did not anticipate or approve of secession. That was kind of revisionist history that happened right after the Civil War. Before the Civil War, most thinking people, most scholarly people, recognized and endorsed the idea of states being able to secede from the Union. You know, it's Lincoln and this war, that, for example, the big theory today, which is like a tidal wave and washes out every other possible rationale for the secession, is that it was all about black slavery. And, of course, that totally ignores historical record. If you, somebody tells you that slavery was the cause of the Civil War, you can answer them and refute them totally and completely with two words, the Corwin Amendment. I guess that's three words, but nonetheless, the Corwin Amendment was the first proposed 13th Amendment. And if all the southern states that seceded had stayed and voted for it, it would have become the actual 13th Amendment to the Constitution. And it's ironic that it's the exact mirror opposite of the 13th Amendment that actually was passed into law after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Because the Corwin Amendment said that slavery would be forever legal and inviolate in all states and territories in which it was in, you know, 1860, for example, or 1861, then legal. So in other words, if the South was seceding to protect its right to have slaves, the Corwin Amendment answered that in their favor. And the fact that they insisted on going forward with secession despite this olive branch of the Corwin Amendment being offered tells you that it was about much more than slavery. In fact, slavery was a small part of it. The big part of it was economic. You know, economically, before the Civil War, there was no income tax, federal income tax. In fact, it was specifically prohibited in the original Constitution. They had to have an amendment to the Constitution later on to have that, to have a an income tax, because it was still, you know, by the time of Woodrow Wilson's administration, still illegal. Mm-hmm. They had one briefly during the Civil War as a special wartime measure, but right after the Civil War, it was abandoned. So if it wasn't about slavery, what was it about? Well, because of there being no legal basis to have an income tax, how did they run the federal government back then? Well, the way they ran the government back then was on excise taxes. And the primary one of those was the excise tax on purchasing foreign manufactured goods. New England in particular was not set up to be an agricultural colony under the Massachusetts Bay Colony. They did have a lot of swiftly running rivers. And what happened, you know, with the that would run water wheels, which prior to the invention of the internal combustion engine was the primary means for running the machinery, mm-hmm. needed to have manufacturing facilities for. So they had that, but they did not have the rich alluvial soil you had in many parts of the South, and the broad, slow-running rivers that basically provided a transportation system to get these agricultural products, cash products, out to the ports for export to the rest of the world. But see, the South had to buy foreign manufactured goods in order to induce European nations like France and Germany and England. Germany, of course, didn't exist as a separate nation until right after the Franco-Prussian War. they were kind of a collection of a motley crew, if you will, of duchies and kingdoms and city-states and other things like that. But France and England did have nations, and back then nations did not tolerate trade imbalances. So if you wanted England and France to buy your cotton and tobacco, then you had to buy something from them, and the logical thing that they produced that we needed was manufactured goods. But that's what all this, you know, conflict about tariff rates was about back then, like the tariff of abominations. The original tariff rate was about 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the late 1820s, under John Quincy Adams, they proposed a new tariff, raising it to about 27%.
This was what precipitated South Carolina's threat to secede, right?
Yeah, that's the tariff of abominations.
Yeah.
And John C. Calhoun said that based on his reading of the Constitution, any state had the right to declare that any, and this was like a kind of halfway house between secession and staying put and just having to eat what Washington told you was the new law. They said that if there is a law passed by the federal government that is contrary to the customs and folkways of a particular state, the state could declare that law a nullity within its borders. And of course, Andrew Jackson was the president then, and he was kind of like the first coming of Donald Trump, I think. And he basically said, you know, I'm going to send the U.S. Army into South Carolina and hang every nullifier from the nearest tree. Well, cooler heads prevailed, and they basically settled on a reduced tariff rate, or a modification, a compromise rate of about 22%.
Which is a vindication of secession as a political tool to moderate, so we say, the federal government, at the same time protect states' rights, these things. The idea of the threat to, like anything, the threat to leave a relationship is a way, it's a negative feedback, if you will, encouraging, you know, responsible behavior among the agent, which is the federal government. The federal government, the states are the principal, the federal government is the agent, at least the way the Constitution understood it. So that's a vindication of that. It's interesting that as early as the 1790s, you had the principles of 98, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions that were penned by Jefferson and Madison, respectively, in response to the Alien Sedition Acts, which established the idea of interposition and nullification. The states protect interposing themselves, those are nullifying laws that were in violation of the Constitution's enumerated powers, meaning the federal government has specific enumerated powers. And so above and beyond that, the federal government has no authority. Of course, the only way to check that is to have institutions among the states to actually check federal officials, because the federal government, as we all know, isn't going to limit its own power if it can get away with it.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we all learned when we were studying American history in the post-Revolutionary War period about the Whiskey Rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that involved a excise tax passed by the federal government on the production of whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And that was controversial with hill farmers, particularly in western Pennsylvania, but other places too. In fact, throughout history, the reason why hill farmers moonshined was that the land that they farmed was not rich enough to grow county prize winning ears of corn. They could grow basically what is called feedlot corn. But feedlot corn works just as well as county prize winning ears when you bake it, grind mm-hmm. mash, and turn it into whiskey. So that's basically, moonshining was the only way that a hill farmer could make money on his corn crop. Stayed that way until the 20th century. But see, that was one of the things that was going on. Another thing, part of the big picture, was that because of the excise taxes, even at the reduced rate of 22%, about 80% of the income that ran the federal government was being generated out of the South. And the North, particularly New England, was the beneficiary.
So you had the South being taxed disproportionately, but the North being more heavily populated controlled had majority control of the Congress, so those interests were being protected, the Northern economic interests, at the expense of the South. Yeah.
That's part of it. The other part of it was that whenever the Whigs were in power, one of their perennial platforms was internal improvements, which tended to be transportation systems like the Pennsylvania Turnpike or the Erie Canal, or increasingly railroads. Railroad owners tended to be the equivalent today of what professional sports owners are. They thought that their product was so valuable to a locale or a city or whatnot that the people ought to pay for their capital expenditures, like, you know, rolling stock and laying rails and, you know, using the power of eminent domain to gain railroad rights of ways and stuff like this. So the South basically was paying 80% of the income or the money that was running the federal government, but 90% of these internal improvements that were helping develop the Midwest and the Northeast and the Middle Atlantic and whatnot, Reading Railroad, Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, groups, things like that, Pennsylvania Railroad, these were being all located in the North. So 80% of the money is coming from the South, but 90% of the federal benefits, the primary federal benefit to come from that, was being spent in the North. So the South basically, to use a homespun phrase, felt like their cow was being milked through the fence. And this was an intolerable situation. And they saw that because of the way of geography, that they were going to consistently be outvoted in Congress. And the only prospect for fair play was going to be secession.
And I think didn't Congress pass the Morrill tariff, which doubled the tariff?
Yeah, that was it. Basically, after, see, what happened in the 1860 presidential election is the type of thing that could happen now. The South was not satisfied with the Democrats, who were the group that would represent their interests in Congress, Stephen Douglas and whatnot. They thought he was weak tea. He wasn't going to be strong enough to really get them the deal that they deserved with the federal government. So they ran two of their own, John Bell and John Breckinridge, and basically split up the anti-Republican vote. Lincoln won the presidency only getting 39% of the vote. Mm-hmm. And it's because the South split up the vote, because you had, just like we have today, we have people that, you know, would say, you know, Trump's not strong enough, this, that, and the other. That's the same dynamic. And, I'm not taking one side or another on that, but I'm saying that's basically what got us into a situation where Lincoln was the president. So the South was sitting back and saying, how bad is this going to be? And then the Morrill tariff was passed. They said, oh, my gosh, this is even worse than we thought. I think the Morrill tariff was going to raise the tariff rate to 47%. They said, we can't live with this. We've got to go. So that's what it was. It was basically our cow being milked through the fence by Northern interests. And, New England was not paying their share. In fact, they were in a win-win. We either, because of the tariff on foreign manufactured goods, we either had to pay the tariff, get the goods from overseas, and pay all this money to the federal government, or we could buy alternative manufactured goods from New England. And, of course, New England's coffers would be filled as a result of that. So they couldn't lose and we couldn't win under that type of, economics situation.
So in the spring of 1861, you have the first round of secession occurs in the winter of 1861. The Deep South secedes from the Union. And then it was after Lincoln, if I have my history correct here, calls up 75,000 troops from the militia to invade the South. And, of course, they have to traverse or go through Virginia to do this. This leads Lee to resign his commission. First, he's offered command of the Union Army of the U.S. Army. Then he rejects it, goes south, and then obviously, and then eventually, because of the commander of the armor in Northern Virginia, most people are familiar with that story. He saw himself as a Virginian first. It's an interesting dynamic. People don't realize now that people didn't see themselves as Americans per se. They were Virginians, they were Marylanders, they were Georgians, they were North Carolina, Carolinians, South Carolina, that sort of thing. But sectionalism was the norm. But Lincoln calls up these troops, and this is what really sparks the Civil War as we know it, so-called, because that's when North Carolina, Virginia, the border states, Tennessee, secede from the Union, and that forms the contours of the conflict, and that creates this clash of armies, at least the sets it up for that. So if Lincoln had not called up the 75,000 troops illegally, because he didn't really have authority to do it on his own, you wouldn't have had that second round of secession. And if the Deep South had been allowed to secede go their own way, you wouldn't have had Virginia or North Carolina or Tennessee seceding from the Union, because their principal opposition was the invasion that Lincoln's war just necessitated. Do I have that right?
Yeah, basically had two waves of secession. The first, seven states, coastal states, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi,
Louisiana. This was referred to as the Gulf State Confederacy, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then that was done, and Lincoln was desperate to provoke some type of movement, some type of aggressive act on the part of the South to justify sending troops in. And he did propose 75,000 troops to come in and invade the South. Well, that, because of that, like you said, you got the last four states, Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, and Virginia to join. And of course, Missouri voted to secede, but just after they voted, Union troops took over the state capitol and arrested everybody in the in the legislature. They did the same thing in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
They were just about to march in the first order, the Congress, so to speak, of Maryland, the legislative body was marching in to take their seats, and the first order of business was secession. Well, they had them arrested as they went in there, and one of the people they arrested was the son of Francis Scott Key, the author of the Star Spangled Banner.
Mm-hmm.
So, and most of these guys were held in prison ships for a large part of the war in the Potomac River. So, now that shows the tyrannical bona fides of Lincoln, that he was willing to do that. Also, he was trying to provoke some type of, aggressive action. And, again, Fort Sumter was mighty weak. They had another coastal fort in Pensacola, Florida. They had these places, and they were trying to provoke the South to fire on them. And they did fire when they started trying to replenish Fort Sumter, which they had before the federal authorities said they were going to abandon. And there was only one federal soldier killed, and that was by accident. He was firing a salute as they left the fort, and the cannon backfired and exploded and killed him. Okay, so there was no loss of life, but he was looking for something like that. And it's really ironic that when the Virginians, who were kind of leaders, spiritually in the South, when their delegation met with Lincoln to discuss, is there a way to head this war off? Lincoln did not say, "What about slavery?" What he said was, "What about my tariff?" It shows you where his mind was. Okay. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are a lot of people that think that John Wilkes Booth was a patsy, kind of like Lee Harvey Oswald was.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you recall that scheme or conspiracy, supposedly, involving the assassination of Lincoln by John Wilkes Booth, that was not the only person that was supposed to be killed. Seward was supposed to be killed, and I think some of the radical Republicans were, but nobody got killed except Lincoln. And maybe John Wilkes Booth was bamboozled by this whole thing, because in the thought being that the radical Republicans knew that Lincoln had said things in the past about freeing the slaves and then sending them back to Africa,
mm-hmm.
or to Central America. And they did not want that because they wanted to punish the South and put them under black tyrannical leadership. People like Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner, who was 6'7" and impotent. He couldn't consummate his marriage. and he's one that Preston Carpenter, William Preston something or other from South Carolina, beat with a cane because Sumner slandered his relative who was in, the South Carolina congressional delegation. But there was just, the goodwill had gone, and the South realized that they were being used financially and that the North was not going to let up. They weren't going to do the right thing. They weren't going to be fair and minded about it. And really, the only thing, it's like a bad marriage. The South decided they needed a divorce, but like most people that get a divorce, they would prefer to have an uncontested one. Mm-hmm. But Lincoln wasn't going to do that. Lincoln basically was not the great liberator or emancipator. In fact, in 1862, I think it was in August, he met with all the black leaders of America and told them, you need to be telling your people that they need to get ready to be shipped overseas. Because I don't think that white people and black people can get along. In fact, that's what Thomas Jefferson said. You have the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., and they have printed there, or not printed, but, engraved, that there's nothing so written, so firmly written in the annals of history or something like this, that the black, this race of people must be freed. And then they stopped it there, but the rest of the quotation was, and it is equally unquestionable that the black race and the white race cannot coexist under the same government. See, so, it may have been that Lincoln was going to go ahead and separate the races, send them back, and the radical Republicans, people like Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens and William Seward and others, basically had their stinger out for the South, and they wanted the South to suffer under a corrupt carpetbag government, which is what they did, okay? And that's why a lot of Southerners left the South and went West, and that's why the cowboys in those old movies spoke with Southern accents. They were trying to get away from the depredations that were being visited upon them by Reconstruction.
Now, you have the war. War comes, as they say, right? War comes. Like an act of God or something. And, of course, the South, initially, the South enjoys some victories, like the second Battle of Manassas. You have Chancellorsville, which is leads us up to Gettysburg, which is the high watermark of the Confederacy, I guess you could say, militarily. And after 1863-64 becomes sort of, because the North is just bringing its resources to bear, greater population, its industrial capacity, and they conquer the South. Of course, much has been said about the viciousness of the war. Sherman's drive to the sea, making Georgia howl. The Shenandoah campaign. So, can you speak to some of the tactics or the war crimes committed by the North to reintegrate the South into the nation?
Well, the United States of America, or the federal government, won the Civil War by the same means that they won World War I and World War II, not by their military might, but by their resources, including human resources. You know, they were getting Irish immigrants off the boat and signing them up in the army before they could set foot on dry land. And the South didn't have that type of immigration. For example, Forrest's second raid on Memphis in 1864 was for the express purpose of liberating all the Confederate prisoners in the Union Bloc prison so he could replenish his ranks. Now, the South was the only area in America to this day to have total war visited upon it and upon its people, like the Sherman's March through Georgia and whatnot. For example, during the entire Civil War, the Civil War in the South, the South's viewpoint should be that nice guys finish last. We could have won the war at the First Battle of Manassas if Beauregard, who was in charge, had pressed his advantage and driven the forces into Washington, D.C. We could have possibly captured Lincoln. If we captured Lincoln, that's how we would have won the war. We would have held him hostage, just like the Texans held Santa Anna hostage. The Texans would never have won that war if they had not captured Santa Anna, who was still the supreme commander of the Mexican forces, and said, "You want to live, you're going to have to come to terms." They could have done the same thing if they had been that ruthless, Southerners with the Northerners. But at that point, they were trying to convince them, look, we don't want your land. We don't want to, commit war crimes and depredations against you. We just want to be, we're like Greta Garbo. We just want to be left alone. Okay. Well, that's what would happen. But see, for example, in the war, there was one northern town burned down by Southern troops. That was Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, by Jubal Early's troops to protest Sherman's March to the Sea. That was standard operating fare for the Union troops. For example, in Mississippi alone, which was not a major theater in the war, 43 towns were burned to the ground by Union forces. See, this is something that they don't teach you, but this, you know, the South, for example, you remember the famous fable of Barber Fritchie, who said, "Shoot if you may, this old gray head, but dare not touch your nation's flag," as Robert E. Lee was going through her hometown in Maryland. Well, see, the reason Lee didn't do anything, he had said early in the war, "We make war against enemy troops in uniform." He said, "We do not make war upon civilians, the aged, children, and women." Okay? And they held to that. But, you know, again, like I said, nice guys finish last. The South did not visit total war on the North, but the North visited total war on the South. And see, that's been America's great advantage throughout history, particularly in the 20th century. We're in the Western Hemisphere. All the wars were in the Eastern Hemisphere, still are today. And as a result, you know, we weren't bombed, we weren't bombarded, we weren't, they didn't burn down our towns and cities like, you know, is going on in Ukraine right now, which happened in all of Europe, basically, except for Spain and a few other, non-belligerent countries. See, America is in the Western Hemisphere, and we're protected by two large moats called the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean that kept all, you know, war affected you if you had a child fighting in the war, but other than that, you know, it was not the great calamity it was if you lived in Germany or if you lived in England or if you lived in Russia or in France. See, and America was spared. The only part of America that's ever had that type of total war visited on it, like happened in World War I and World War II, was the South. For example, the Sultana tragedy, where all these Union troops that were in a weakened condition died. It was the greatest maritime disaster of all time in terms of total loss of life. You had more people die in the sinking of the Sultana, which was on the Mississippi River right outside of Memphis, than died in the Titanic. But the reason these people were so weakened and couldn't swim and drowned is because they were coming from Confederate prison camps, and the Southerners in charge of those prison camps, for example, at Andersonville, Willard Wirtz, a Swiss national that came over and joined the Confederacy, was in charge of Andersonville. He tried on two separate occasions to parole all of his prisoners to the provisional state governor of Florida. The Yankees had taken over Florida, and Andersonville was right on the Georgia-Florida line, and he was trying to say, look, we'll give you all these prisoners. Well, Lincoln wouldn't let him do it because he wanted those prisoners to be a burden on the South. And those prisoners were getting the same rations as the Confederate soldiers that were, garrisoned and guarding them. But because of Sherman's march through the sea, all the foodstuffs, all the grains, and they were burning down all the crops in the field. They were slaughtering all the wildlife, going by, burning down houses, stealing everything in sight, raping the women, all of this type of stuff. But never had anything like that happen in the North, which I guess is one of the reasons why the North wasn't as vengeful as the vengefulness came from the radical Republicans, who were basically like the olden days equivalent of Antifa today. They're just a bunch of wild-eyed leftist goons, basically like Robespierre and Saint Just and people like this in the French Revolution.
Yeah, if you want to get a taste of their attitude, the movie, Clint Eastwood movie, Outlaw Josie Wales.
Yeah.
The beginning, I think John Carradine plays a radical Republican senator who orchestrates a massacre of Confederate soldiers surrendering. And this, of course, Josie Wales escapes. They're massacred with a Gatling gun, and he escapes, and that's what starts the story. But the senator, played by John Carradine, is supposed to be a radical Republican who thinks that all the traitors should be shot dead, for fighting for the South.
So you get all these fantasies like Josie Wales mowing them all down. That's not what happened in real life. It's like in the French Revolution, they had the great revenge fantasy of what was the guy's name? The Scarlet Pimpernel and whatnot.
Oh yeah, yes.
Well, see, everybody dreams of being rescued, but it don't happen in real life, So that's what we're dealing with, and I mean, these people, see, out there on the Kansas Missouri border, it was really rough. Okay, and I like Shelby Foote's report of a Union officer from the Northeast who had captured some Southerners, and he was lecturing one, Southern private or whatnot, and said, what in the world are you fighting this war for? Why are you trying to, prevent black liberation? Said, don't you see that you're treated just as bad as any blacks and whatnot? He said, well, he said, we're not fighting for that. And he said, what are you fighting for? And he said, because you're down here.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Basically, you invaded our land, and you're trying to put us in you're trying to tyrannically rule over us. And, that's why the South basically had no reason to, fight except for self-preservation. But then on the other hand, the South did not go into the North. You had the St. Albans raid in New Hampshire. There's a nice movie made by a Mexican director starring Van Heflin called The Raid and stuff like that. That was Judah Benjamin, the one Jew in the Confederate cabinet, and he wanted to get at their money. So he sent people, Confederates, to Canada and they would put on their uniforms, go down there and, you know, rob these banks and whatnot. That happened a few times. But basically, between that and John, General Shelby's raid in Kentucky, which really was part of the South, they would have, if they'd been allowed to secede, they would have, just like Maryland and Missouri. But we just, you know, we did not respond in kind. And it was because we fought a gentleman's war, and, you know, what was motivating, you know, the Union troops was something like the Vendée in the French Revolution. You know, they were going to win by hook or crook, and, you know, Sherman said, you know, war is hell, and we're going to, you know, we're going to make Georgia howl, like you said. You know, they basically intended to be bloodthirsty and cruel and brutal, and the South was not that way. But of course, like I said, nice guys finish last.
Yeah, of course, the war ends 1865, and then you have the Reconstruction period to 1877, roughly. And in that period, you have of course the Reconstruction amendments passed unconstitutionally, mind you, because the states are forced to ratify the amendments as a condition for their reintegration of the Union, which contradicted the argument that they never left. But right. they had won the war; they could dictate the rules. So the states are forced to ratify the amendment. I mean, even the 14th Amendment never was technically ratified. I think a senator was expelled from New Jersey for not voting for it because of the problems they had with it. But you have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment passed. And this Reconstruction ends after 1877 when you have that, I guess, the deal regarding the Rutherford B. Hayes-Tilden election, you know, where a deal struck in the House of Representatives to give Rutherford B. Hayes the presidency. The Union Army, after occupying for a dozen years or so, leaves. And, of course, Reconstruction governments collapse. A lot of these were governments that were imposed. Like Guido said, but you had, like, black proxies, illiterate blacks serving in the Senate. And this was supposed to be a milestone, a great thing, but they were just a front for carpetbaggers and scalawags who were raping and pillaging the South. All the destruction that occurred. But then you have this period between 1877 and really the 1960s, 50s and 60s, almost a century, where the South is kind of left alone in a way, meaning that you have Jim Crow imposed these restrictions.
Well, like Greta Garbo said, what do you want? She said, I want to be left alone. They left us alone, basically.
Yeah.
Period of time.
And, of course, that changes after World War II. You have the Civil Rights Movement, which is sort of like the second imposition of second Reconstruction. And this coincides with changes in America. You had the sort of the interstate highway system, mass communication, particularly television, and the national media, which is pretty much New York, right, controlled by certain groups. And they could present an image, a narrative, if you will, of what was going on in the South, what had gone on in the South. And all of a sudden, because if you follow the historiography of the Civil War, you know, from the 1900 up until the 1950s or 60s, nothing is much made of slavery or the racial issue. It's much, you know, the historiography is pretty generally accurate, meaning that the division lines between North and South are economic, it's cultural, but then to fit with contemporary or modern political issues, the historiography changes, and all of a sudden you have slavery being made an issue because of this burgeoning civil rights movement, which had the support of the establishment. One of the, I guess, false narratives of history is that the civil rights movement was indeed a protest movement. Now, I guess in some southern areas it could be perceived as a protest movement, but it was a protest movement that had the support of the national regime, of the national media. And with modern television and modern communication, these images could be presented to the rest of the country, the South, as being this backwater tyrannical state, treating, you know, the oppressed black minority poorly. And that's a narrative. And also you have movies like To Kill a Mockingbird, based on the book. And of course, this is agitprop, the same way that Uncle Tom's Cabin was, right? It
Yeah.
presents an image. You know, it's an image. It's a project. It's just one narrative of a very complex thing going on in the South. So I'm being long-winded here. What was going on in the South in between that time period? I mean, obviously, almost 80, 90 years, but the Civil Rights Movement in the 50s and 60s. Is my characterization the Civil Rights Movement as kind of a fake protest movement correct?
Yeah. First of all, let's go back to the end of Reconstruction. What was the first big law that the redemptionists, that's what they called the white Southerners that took over the state governments after the black Reconstruction governments fell in 1877? The first big law was the Posse Comitatus Act. We've heard Posse Comitatus Act before, or we've heard Posse Comitatus. And a lot of people have heard it, they don't really realize what it was or what its significance was. What it was a law that said that the federal military can never again be used as a police force against the citizens of the United States, which is what they did during the Reconstruction era. They had like race riot in Memphis is because they had all these black federal troops here that were, basically tyrannically pushing people around and whatnot. So basically, Posse Comitatus was supposed to stop that. But then, ironically, in the civil rights movement, the federal government went right back to using the federal military as a police force against Southerners, like in the integration of Little Rock Central High School in 1957, where the 101st Airborne is seen with, you can see the film of it, marching white kids to school at the point of a bayonet, okay? And likewise, the same thing happened at Ole Miss in 1962 with the integration of the University of Mississippi, James Meredith. They did the same thing. They use these federal, and see, nobody knows about that. That doesn't mean the South and people like Orville Faubus in Arkansas and Ross Barnett in Mississippi were making these arguments, but they weren't being reported because Jewish power and influence, most, what are Jews, the most liberal part of the white population in America, they were in control of all the media and also the entertainment industry. And basically, what you saw in all this old footage about, let's say, Selma Bridge, and poor John Lewis, look at those things carefully. That, we saw recently with Tyre Nichol how brutal black policemen can be and traditionally were. We knew that back in Memphis, for example, in the days of segregation, which I remember because I'm old enough. Black people didn't like being arrested by white police officers. It was an affront to them. So, how did the evil segregationists handle that? Well, they just hired black patrolmen to police the black precincts. But even back then, black policemen were known for being particularly brutal with their arrest methods and stuff like this. But apparently, black people would rather get the stuffing beat out of them by these people, these black patrolmen, rather than just be arrested by whites. So they put up with it. That's what they want. Now, the sergeants, the lieutenants, the captains, and whatnot, they were all white, but the patrolmen in the black neighborhoods were black. And that's why they were black. Okay? But look, compare what you saw in those films of Tyre Nichol with the films that you've seen of the civil rights movement and the so-called bloodthirsty Bull Connor. Bull Connor, in compared to the five black officers in the Tyre Nichols affair, looks like Mr. Rogers, okay? You don't see him beating the crap out of people. Basically, you had water hoses. That's a pretty soft way to control crowds, hitting them with a water hose, or police dogs on leashes. If you didn't want to get beaten by, I mean, bitten by the dog, just back up, okay? You didn't have to do this. But see, the whole thing was a theatrical production. Who is in charge of the theatrical production? The same people that are in charge of all of our theatrical productions, Jewish Hollywood. For example, they had these places, like they had a staging area in Oxford, Ohio, which is where Miami of Ohio is located, and the main one was the Highlander Folk School in Monteagle, Tennessee, just on the Tennessee side of the border from Alabama. They would funnel these prospective civil rights workers into those places and basically give them acting lessons about how to portray themselves to best advantage for to change hearts and minds in the North and in the world generally.
And knowing that CBS News would be down there with the cameras rolling, right?
Yeah, and they knew who was rolling those cameras. They were complicit with the whole thing, the people that were doing it. For example, they would not show you the blacks spitting on the police, throwing dog feces on the police, throwing cups of urine on the police. But once they got them stirred up, then and only then would the cameras start to roll. But even then, what they did pales in comparison to real police brutality, which is what we saw in Tyre Nichols recently. What you saw, for example, did you ever think it was kind of odd that all these civil rights movement protesters looked the same? They were all slim. They were all, the men were wearing white shirts with a single colored tie. They were wearing horn rimmed glass. They looked like it was a casting call for the role of Urkel in Family Ties. And the girls were wearing, they didn't have any fat slobs. They didn't, the girls were wearing little page boy collars, shirts and whatnot, and modest dresses and everything. And they were, no fat sews, no fat slobs, no, zoot suits, any of this stuff. That was all by design. They, it was, this kind of stoic demeanor they had. They never had that in the run-up, but when the camera started to roll, that's what they did. And, of course, if they got some camera footage of the other, they just cut that out. They were in charge of the whole thing, okay? And it was demoralizing to the South because the South had wonderful arguments to counter what they had to say, but they were never being heard. They were, this was back in the time when I was in college. They had a book by Marshall McLuhan called The Medium is a Message, which basically is if you control the medium, you control the message. Well, they proved that in the civil rights movement. And basically, the South basically suffered a mass infliction of Stockholm syndrome. They said, just stop hitting us. We'll confess to anything. And that's what happened. And that's what you get now with the typical normie conservatives that represent us through the Republican Party here in the South and everywhere else. A Republican congressman or senator would rather be called a pedophile than a racist. And they know this. They cower from this charge and whatnot. And basically what you need to say is, so what? I like the comment that was made by some guy named David Soule on the trying to explain the Tyre Nichols situation where a black guy is killed by five black cops. He said, all our skin folk ain't kinfolk. I said, well, that's a wonderful slogan. I want to use it for white people because it certainly applies more to us. Mm-hmm. With all these people from Antifa and elsewhere, who are anti-white in their animus and in all of their political instincts, they are our skin folk, but they sure ain't our kin folk. And that's our problem. It's a much bigger problem in the white community than it is in the black community. Black people that don't go along with the left's orthodoxy on race are few and far between. On the other hand, probably about 50% of the white population is anti-white. Mm-hmm. America today.
Yeah, the white guilt instilled by the civil rights narrative, the racial ideology or racial narrative and civil rights ideology, rather, that kind of informs most people's views or at least a collective memory of those things, or at least how they're told how it all went down. The country, we talk about our Constitution and we say that's the longest functioning Constitution to date, but really the Constitution has been fundamentally changed. first through the, of course, the American, so-called American Civil War. As you point out, it wasn't really a civil war because the South wasn't fighting for control of Washington, D.C. It was fighting for secession. It's propaganda. They call it the Civil War.
We're not trying to take over their government. We're just trying to
leave. Yeah.
Okay. And for example, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, what they did in the Civil Rights Movement. Well, see, the Civil Rights Movement was a stage production, and that's what you need to keep in mind. The whole thing was, and basically you didn't get the arguments. For example, you're talking about the Constitution. The old Constitution died with the Civil War, the Constitution that we were, you know, and they never anticipated we would have a federal government that would usurp as much power to itself as happened with Lincoln's government, and then even worse, the radical Republicans. And then how do we explain the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, I mean, you had obviously the Civil War consolidation, the ending of states' rights. And then you had, you could roughly call it the kind of the managerial revolution that occurred with the New Deal and the Second World War. So this growth of Leviathan. Then you had the second Reconstruction period of the 1960s, you could call it, the reoccupation of the South.
That's right. And,
yeah.
And see, here's the way I see that having folded out, okay? In the 1890s, you started to have, for the first time, large numbers of Jews coming to America from Eastern Europe. They were radical over there. Basically, the first great wave of immigration in the 1850s, late 1840s, that came about through the first wave of Marxist revolutions in Europe, and a lot of the people that lost, the radicals, wound up coming over here.
That's right, the 1848ers who took part in Lincoln's War.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, and you know, Lincoln was a pen pal of Karl Marx's. They wrote to each other and, you know, shared strategy together. But what happened once, in the second wave of immigration from 1890 to the 1920s, you had people from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, and the Eastern Europeans, a lot of them tended to be Ashkenazi Jews. Ashkenazis are 85% of the world's Jewish population now. And these are the people whose ancestors never set foot in the Holy Land.
No, they're Turkic, I think, yeah.
Yeah, they were from, you know, the Caucasus Mountains area. The Caucasus Mountains are between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea and what. And when they came over, everywhere they've gone, they've been basically, as Kevin McDonald calls it, a people who shall dwell apart. They made, see, what happened originally was when they were driven out of Palestine in AD 70. How did they get driven out? They got driven out because the Romans, who were basically pretty benign empire builders by ancient standards, they would let you have your own religion and your own nation. You just had to assent to Rome's authority and preeminence in legal and civil matters and in matters of trade and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But by AD 70, the Roman emperor said, "You people are effing crazy," okay, to the Jews generally. He said, "You're the most troublesome province in the entire Roman Empire. We're always having to send troops over there to quell rebellions at great expense to us. And your argument, if you'd have an argument with a doorknob, okay?" And they said, as a result, we're not going to be so cruel as to kill you all, but you have forfeited your right to have your own nation, so we're going to disperse you. That's the so-called diaspora. And they were hoping that they would assimilate and blend in with the other parts of the Roman Empire where they were sent. But they decided, as a matter of principle, they weren't going to do it. That's where, you know, you got the a people who shall dwell apart from.
Yeah, I think this is the birth of Talmudic Judaism.
Right, it was. Yeah. And see, what happened was, you know, the worst thing you can do is try to be a nice guy to them. That's what the Tsar did in Russia, and as a result, they hated Russia.
That's right. There's Russia took, there's Stepan, I think it was Stolypin and some of the other reformers I think even before Stolypin, but in the 19th century, they actually tried to, they gave them land grants and tried to get them agricultural, thought they would normalize them. But
they
they
tried
never,
to
they
come
never.
out of the cities. They said, you can be here, but you got to be in the rural areas because you will, really, go hog wild and pig crazy if we let you in the cities. Well, what Jews have always specialized in is vice. Remember, they used to have vice squads in the police department. What is vice? Vice are kind of like low-level criminal activity, like pornography or
Yeah.
prostitution or gambling.
Socially destructive behavior, you
Yeah,
know. Yeah.
right.
This isn't
Things.
necessarily violent, but it's corrosive. Yeah.
Right. Well, Jews have always specialized in that because it serves two of their goals. One, it makes money, and two, it corrupts the morals of the goy. That's what they did in Russia. They basically had control of the liquor industry. They would get the Russian peasants hooked on alcohol. They would have to borrow money from them. They would take mortgages on their farms and then foreclose on their farms. And when the Russian peasantry figured out what was going on, that's what led to the pogroms. Okay? Well, they left. A lot of them came to America and they said, "Oy vey, we've never found a place like this before." Okay? This is, these people are like sheep. They're just, they're so welcoming and letting us get into everything. So that's what they did. They came to America. And of course, Jewish leftists and leftists generally basically held their breath when World War I happened, because this is the global war that Marx and Engels had predicted. And they said that the proletariat will be armed. And once armed, it'll be a small matter to convince them that they have more in common with their proletarian, fellow proletarians on the other side of the trench line than with the bourgeoisie officer corps. They will become the functional definition of a proletariat, which is the spear point of the revolution. And that indeed is what happened in Russia, with the storming of the Winter Palace and the taking over the battleship Potemkin. But they had much grander visions than just taking over Russia. They took over Hungary for 4 months under Belikan. They took over Bavaria for 2 months under Kurt Eisner. They took over Berlin for 1 weekend under Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg in the Spartacist revolution. But basically, it petered out everywhere else.
Yeah, the
And
Freikorps crushed them or something, right? Yeah.
yeah, right, yeah. Well, see, what happened was in every European nation, a grassroots resistance to this communist takeover cropped up. Hitler was the guy that came to the head of the class in Germany, Mussolini in Italy, Franco in Spain, Oswald Mosley in England, people like this, Quisling in Norway. And they all discovered something unique and surprising about their communist enemies. They were a fascist was an anti-communist, okay? And back then, they learned that about three quarters of the population of the Communist Party in Germany or in Italy or in Spain or whatnot were Jewish. So being a communist just about became a synonym with being Jewish back then. Well,
Even Churchill wrote that, didn't he?
yeah, he did in 1821. But see, they can always find goys to be corrupted. That's what they did with Woodrow Wilson. He was having an affair with a woman that lived next door, and she had a son that had a $40,000 debt that he was about to get in big trouble for, maybe criminal charges. This Samuel Untermeyer,
Yes. Yeah.
a Jewish lawyer in New York, managed to get him $40,000, and basically they got him in his hip pocket.
He commissions the Scofield Bible, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. That's one of the Lotus Club in New York supported Scofield when he went to Oxford,
And
England.
he pays Oxford Press to publish
Yeah,
it.
well, they got him over there, and see,
Yeah.
the Lotus Club was just filled with Jews. See, there are a lot of people that are confused about the Masons. I say the Masons. It's not the Jews, it's the Masons. Well, what were the Masons? The Masons was the one intellectual group of powerful people. It was a semi-secret group. And these people, it didn't matter. You could be a Catholic, you could be a Protestant, you could be a Jew. Well, yes, they wound up taking over the most.
Well, they always do.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, see that's how we got into that. But see, what happened
If they're not excluded, they take it over.
Well, see what happened in World War One. First of all, let's look at Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was a Southerner. He was a president of Princeton. They got him in on purpose. They basically played on Teddy Roosevelt's large ego and got him to split the Republican vote by forming a third party, the Bull Moose Party, and running against the Republican Taft. And if you'll notice, since the Civil War up until the Woodrow Wilson administration in 1912, there was only one Democratic president during that term. The Republicans ruled. You know, the Republicans were for Lincoln and liberty, and the Democrats were rum, Romanism, and rebellion. Romanism were the Roman Catholics. The rum was, you know, opposition to the
It
pro.
was what Grover Cleveland serving two non-consecutive terms.
That's right. Yeah, he was the only one. But see, then they broke that lock through Jewish machinations. They basically persuaded Teddy Roosevelt to run, split the Republican vote. Then, as soon as they got their Democrat Woodrow Wilson in there, boom, 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 you have the 16th Amendment, an income tax. You have the 17th Amendment, direct vote for senators. It used to be that senators were elected by the state legislature, and it's a safeguard for states' rights. Well, they were weakening states' rights by doing that. They had the Federal Reserve Act, Paul Warburg. And the creature from Jekyll Island. I went to Jekyll Island and saw those little places where they were staying when they were concocting the Federal Reserve. But see, all of this stuff was done in the early years of the Woodrow Wilson administration. Then Woodrow Wilson got elected on the idea that he was, you know, he kept us out of war. And within a month after he got back in, we were in war.
Yeah, which was a fulfillment of the Balfour Declaration.
Yeah, what happened was, at least my understanding is this. What happened was, in the first half of the First World War, world Jewry was totally behind Germany. Why? Not because they liked the Germans so much, but they hated the Russians so much. And they saw Germany as Russia's big enemy. Well, England was about to give up. They run out of gas. See, the problem with somebody like Winston Churchill is he thought that 1915 should be just like 1815 when England was at top of the world after the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo. But England did not have, you know, the substance to support that type of swagger anymore. They had to get every member of their Anglosphere totally behind them in order to even project power. Somewhat, and see, Churchill, even in World War One, was a big warmonger. He said in a famous letter that he wrote to his wife, he said, "I know it's a terrible thing to say because so many people suffer from it, but I just love war." Okay. He saw that as a way to promote himself.
Well, I mean, he'd gotten famous during the Boer War, which was the Rothschild operation.
Yeah, it was, and you know, again, it was just whipping up on, you know, a bunch of, you know, insurgent farmers, basically. But then he's the only, you know, Churchill loved warfare, but he was a terrible soldier. He was the only Allied commander to lose a major engagement to the Ottoman Turks in World War I at Gallipoli. I mean, this guy was pathetic, but he that you know, he needed Jewish help. And that's what he got. And see, they were about to go under. They were about to just make peace with the Germans. The Germans hadn't wanted war with Britain in World War One or World War Two, but it was forced on them by the English, basically under Winston Churchill, definitely in World War Two, and a little more subtly in World War One. But in World War One, in 1916. World Jewry said, "You don't have to make peace with the Germans. You can defeat them because we can get America into the war on your side, but it'll cost you." And the English said, "Well, what'll it cost us?" Said, "Well, the Germans can't give us this because they're allied with the Ottoman Turks that control the Holy Land and most of the rest of the, you know, Arabian Peninsula and all of that area." Said, "If you win, you need to arrange it so that you gain control, a kind of protectorate over Palestine, and then you let Jews freely emigrate to Palestine with an eye towards eventually creating a Jewish nation. Of course, nobody consulted the Arabs that lived there.
No.
But they made that deal, and then once they got America into the war through, you know, their toady Woodrow Wilson, they said, we want this in writing so that there's no question about the deal. So that's where the Balfour Declaration came from that you're talking about. And see, that's how America got involved. And they were sending like anywhere from 100,000 to 250,000 troops a month in 1918 over there, and it broke the Germans back. The Germans did not want to see their homeland decimated the way the French had with trench warfare. So as they got up to the border, they were led to believe that they could have a reasonable peace. They went ahead and surrendered the armistice. But then, you know, Wilson was not that, you know, he was considered kind of a joke by people like Clemenceau and David Lloyd George and Vittorio Orlando from Italy. And they made sure that they were as vengeful as they could possibly be with the Germans, okay? And the Jews were making money off of all of this. You know, they basically controlled. And, of course, the one thing that Hitler did that sealed his fate was, you know, he came into power in January of 1933. One of the first things he did was run the Rothschilds out of the Central Bank of Germany, and also a lot of the Jewish people that were running the Weimar Republic government, he fired them and replaced them with, you know, ethnic Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, look, people forget this, but Adolf Hitler was Time Magazine's Man of the Year in 1938 because of the economic miracle he had wrought in Germany. He said, we don't need the Jews in here. I can print up money as well as they can. And that's what he did. And then he had a big public works program, their equivalent of the interstate highway system, the Autobahn, and things like that.
Yeah, it was basically currency backed by German labor, which is very valuable.
So they were doing great.
Yeah.
Okay. And he was, everybody was wondering about this miracle. And Germany was the only European nation to get out of the Depression before World War II. And that's how they were able to do it. But, you know, in March of 1933, World Jewry created a trade embargo on Germany. And they knew that Germany could only produce about 70% of the food they needed to feed the German population. And if they could prevent Germany from manufacturing their high-quality manufactured goods overseas, then they would have a shortfall of 30%, you know, and that 30% of the population would starve.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. People don't realize that as early as 1933, there is an international organization that could organize an international boycott, and that organization was Jewish. You had the World Jewish Council, and they could organize a boycott, meaning that there was an entity there functioning as a Jewish organization that indeed had declared economic warfare on Germany.
Yeah, and one of the things they did under Wilson, they wanted to have a member of the Supreme Court, so they picked Louis Brandeis, who was probably the preeminent Zionist among the Jews in American society at that time. I remember Justice McReynolds, James McReynolds of Tennessee, was on the Supreme Court, and he was so offended by the whole thing that he refused to sit in a group photograph with Brandeis.
Mm-hmm.
But see, most people weren't as prescient as he was. But
well, first Jew put on the Supreme Court, Woodrow Wilson. That's sort of lionized or praised in history as sort of a landmark, decision taken by Wilson. But it turns out he was a member of a Jewish secret society called the Purushan, I think, and he was a Zionist agent, meaning the very suspicions people have appointing someone of that persuasion were vindicated because he was primarily working for Jewish interests as a Supreme Court justice.
It's like the Wizard of Oz. Don't pay any attention to that little man behind the screen. But see,
the same with Felix Frankfurter, his protege. Yeah.
Well, Felix Frankfurter, that's a very interesting story about how they got the Brown versus Topeka Board of Education decision.
Yeah, bring it back to the South is you obviously in the 50s you have this landmark decision, Brown versus Board, which was sort of, again, another rigged decision, right?
Yeah, well, let's go back a little bit further now to World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Franklin Roosevelt likewise was under their thumb. He was a socialist just like Stalin, and he actually preferred Stalin's company to Churchill's. And it was Churchill that really got a bucket of ice water in his face at Yalta when he saw that Uncle Joe Stalin and Roosevelt were yucking it up thick as thieves, and he was kind of on the outside looking in. But what happened in America, what they did ever since, the last real conservative Democrat to run for president was Wardwell Polk and Davis, John W. Davis, okay, in 1924, lost to Calvin Coolidge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And ever since then, what they did was they would always, to keep the solid South solidly behind the Democrats, they would have a Northern liberal run as the president and a Southern conservative run as the vice president, like John Nance Garner of Texas, Cactus Jack, and people like that, okay?
That's right. John Nance Garner actually condemned Herbert Hoover as a socialist for his big spending.
Right, exactly, yeah. But see...
So did Roosevelt in his 1932 campaign.
Right. Well, see, in 1940... They picked what was it?
Wilkie.
Well, Harry Dexter White or something. Who was the vice president for Roosevelt at that time in the 1940 election? They kind of broke with that, and they got a guy who was
a guy from Wisconsin.
Yeah, was it Harry Dexter White?
Not Harry Dexter White. He was the assistant treasury secretary.
What was the guy's name?
Wallace.
Yeah, Henry Wallace.
Henry Wallace, yeah. Sort of a mystic or something, yeah.
Yeah, well, Wallace was going to be too weirdo, but there was a South Carolinian named Jimmy Burns who was in the South Carolinian congressional delegation.
Oh, that's right. He eventually became Secretary of State, didn't he?
Yeah, well, here's what happened with him. He's a key figure, okay? He was elevated to the Supreme Court by Roosevelt. But after serving for 15 months, Roosevelt asked him to step aside so he would head up the War Mobilization Office for World War II. And this is right after Pearl Harbor. Well, Burns was a pretty sharp cookie. And he said, I'll resign and do it if you'll make me your vice presidential candidate in 1944. And Roosevelt said that he would. But the Jews already had the civil rights movement on the drawing board, and they knew that they did not want a guy. Everybody also realized that Roosevelt had one foot in the grave and another on a banana peel in the run-up to the 44 election. So they knew that whoever got this vice presidential candidate is liable to wind up the president of the United States. Burns realized it, too.
So it would be the haberdasher from Missouri, right?
Well, his middle name is Solomon, and some people think that he has Jewish ancestry, okay?
And he also is the one that recognizes Israel, right?
Yeah, he was he was either a tool or a Jew, kind of.
Well, he had some pretty harsh things to say about him, too, from what I understand.
Well, here's what happened. See, they put him in ahead of Burns, okay? And see, just think of how the history would have been different if Burns had been the president up until 1956, let's say. During that time, you had a staunch segregationist, which is what Jimmy Burns was, as the president of the United States. Or let's say that he read Roosevelt correctly and realized that he wasn't a guy whose word you could trust and said, thanks, but no thanks, I'll just stay here on the Supreme Court. Well, he could have blocked the Brown decision and other integrationist decisions like Sweat versus Painter, Shelley versus Kramer. These other things, as a staunch segregationist. Frankfurter was the architect of the Brown decision. He worked behind the scenes with a former law clerk, another member of the tribe named Philip Elman, okay? And Ellman confessed to his complicity with Frankfurter in the run-up to that decision in a 1987 Harvard Law Review article, bragging about it. They were meeting like Deep Throat in Watergate in parking garages and things like this. Basically, Frankfurter was giving Ellman, who worked for the U.S. Solicitor General's office and was supporting because the NAACP in the Brown litigation, because that's what, you know, Harry Truman wanted. Okay.
And the NAACP was also Jewish controlled.
Oh, yeah, right. You know, they should have gotten a paper cutout, you know, like a styrofoam board cutout of Thurgood Marshall and put it up there, because all the arguments were being made by Jack Greenberg, another member of the tribe, with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. They were doing all of that. And basically, Frankfurter wanted to have a unanimous decision because this was such a cataclysmic change in law. Well, they basically abandoned all the normal protocols for deciding appellate cases in the Brown decision. For example, normally you depend on stare decisis, case precedent, other cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the case precedent was very clear, and it was against them. It was Plessy versus Ferguson.
Yeah, separate but equal.
See, the whole principle was separate but equal satisfies the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. In other words, you're not denying black people or anyone else of their 14th Amendment right to equal protection if they are, if they have separate but equal facilities, like a separate but equal train car, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Plessy versus Ferguson was about, or schools. Well, Jews, and Frankfurt in particular, wanted the separate but equal doctrine struck down, that it could not apply anymore. They didn't want to go through a brush war of decisions where they said, well, you got the separate right, but you don't have the equal right, and we need to do this, adjust things. They didn't want that. They wanted to basically turn the South's society on its head, and basically what they managed to do is make it so expensive and difficult to have children. You know, that's why they started sending them to the segregation academies and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly children were a big financial burden. You know, you had to spend money to send them to private schools. And that was not an accident. That's what they intended to do. But, you know, first of all, stare decisis, they didn't have that. Then if you have a statute or a constitutional provision, you can either use rules of statutory construction or legislative history. Well, they didn't work with either of that. They specifically, when after the first argument, the Chief Justice at the time was Fred Vincent of Kentucky. And when it looked as if they were not going to win, that they were basically going to say, well, separate but equal is still the law, and maybe, you know, you got the separate right but not the equal, and you need to, you know, equalize per pupil expenditures between blacks and whites, and if you don't do that, then we may, you know, decide that you need to have a unitary school system, no segregation. That would have been fine. That would have been what you're normally supposed to do in an appellate decision. You're supposed to not upset the apple cart like they wanted to do. You're supposed to make changes, make the decision in the least disruptive way possible, which would have been to say that separate but equal is all right, but you don't have the equal right, and you need to work on that and give them specific directions about doing that. But they didn't do that. And they tried to find out, they said, prove to us, there's a guy named Alexander Bickel, who later became a Yale law professor, who was a law clerk at the time on the Supreme Court for Frankfurter, I believe. And Frankfurter said, look at the legislative history and find an excuse where we can say that the same legislature that passed the 14th Amendment would not have approved of racially segregated public education. Well, he came back and said, not only is there no support for your position, the historical record is directly opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 1867, the Congress in 1867 that ratified the 14th Amendment, back in those days, also governed the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia didn't have a mayor and a city council and all of that, or school boards. They were run by Congress. Well, the same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment also created a racially segregated school system in the District of Columbia. So they said, oh, shit. So
in Latin.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So what did they do about that? Well, what they did was they got basically in September of 1953, in between the first hearing and the rehearing, Fred Vinson died of a heart attack. And Ellman wrote about this in his Law Review article. He said he met secretly with Frankfurter, and Frankfurter put on this mock sorrow and said, I'm shocked. And then he confided to him. He said, you know, Vincent's death is the first real evidence I've ever had of the existence of God. Okay. That's what he said. Well, then they got Earl Warren in. Earl Warren got in through a corrupt bargain himself at the 1952 Republican presidential convention. He was running. Eisenhower was running against Mr. Conservative Robert Taft, who you mentioned earlier, okay? Robert Taft's original address on, domestic policy, he was not a conservative. He was, in fact, the guy that he had give his nominating speech was Lieutenant George W. Lee, a black and tan Republican from Memphis, whose, I think, primary role in life as a head of the black and tan Republicans was whenever a Republican would wind up being the president. Of course, he never gave, you know, brought Tennessee into the fold and got electoral votes for any Republican candidate for president from Tennessee. But when you happen to have a Republican president, he would make sure that they hired as many black Memphians as possible for the Postal Service. In Memphis, you have all these, in the ghettos, you have these little post offices, and they're all Lieutenant George W. Lee post offices. Why was it Lieutenant Lee? Well, in World War I, he was a black man. He became a lieutenant. And it was so rare for a black man to become an officer in the military at that time that, you know, just like guys would go through the rest of their life, I was colonel this or I was general that. Well, he was lieutenant George W. Lee for the rest of his career. But see, Taft was, his conservatism basically expressed itself in foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
But he was running against Eisenhower. Eisenhower needed California's, I think it was at the time, 45 electoral votes. Earl Warren was governor of California. He was in charge of the Republican Party there, and he made a little backrooms deal with Eisenhower. He said, I will provide you with all of California's electoral votes, and you'll win the nomination if you will appoint me to the first opening you have on the U.S. Supreme Court. And he said, done. Okay. Then when Vinson died, it just so happened that the opening was for the Chief Justice, so he became the Chief Justice. He was not a great legal scholar by any stretch of the imagination. Was, excuse me, let me turn this thing off here. But anyway, he was not a, Earl Warren was not a legal scholar, but he was a power politician.
Mm-hmm.
The way they decided to decide this case was on sociology. Unprecedented, absolutely outrageous.
It wasn't a doll test or something, Kenneth Clark.
Yeah, right. Kenneth Clark was a black sociologist, and he supposedly had run these doll studies where children in segregated versus integrated schools were shown two dolls, black children, one white, one black. They'd ask the child, which one do you think is prettier or better and why? And if black children choosing the black doll meant that their great leap of faith here, of course, that their self-image and self-esteem was negatively affected by racial segregation. Now, how in the hell you get that, we don't know. But anyway.
Oh, white people's?
Yeah.
Affected right. by that equally? Or?
Well, here's the thing is, they didn't even present this honestly to the court because what they see, more black children were picking the white doll than the black doll, and that's what they based it on.
Okay, so for that you overturn stare decisis and distort the Constitution.
But more than that, they didn't tell them that they ran these studies in two locales. One was Massachusetts that had a racially integrated public school system, and the other in Arkansas, which had a racially segregated school system. And guess what? Even though black children picked the white doll more often, the black children in Arkansas picked the black doll more frequently than the black children in Massachusetts. So it would seem to show that in a racially segregated setting, their self-esteem was enhanced by a racially segregated school system rather than the opposite way around. And of course, that makes sense because in a racially segregated school system, you're not having to compare yourself to white kids and Asian kids and others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But that was all hidden from the court. The whole thing was basically in that when that 87 Harvard Law Review article came out, Elvin thought he was going to be lionized, that people were going to say this was so important, it was so wonderful that you decided to, overlook all the normal protocols for deciding appellate cases and came out with the quote-unquote right decision. Irwin Griswold, who I think was the dean of Harvard Law School, said that this was an outrage and that basically if they had known about this, Frankfurter should have been kicked off of the court for a violation of the canon of judicial conduct, okay, by doing this.
Well, it's a corruption of the judicial process, the constitutional system. And basically, they're using the court to engage in social engineering. I guess a lot of this is informed by that book that had been written 14 years before, which is The American Dilemma by Meyerdahl.
Yeah, this is the problem we always have. All of our experts on race relations are people that live in areas where there are no appreciable numbers of blacks.
Yeah, he's Scandinavian.
Well, see, my father, he got a job, some Army buddies got him a job in an electrician's apprenticeship program, so he moved to Minnesota. I was born up there. And I asked him about that, and he said the people, the white people up in Minnesota were just salt of the earth. They give you the shirt off their back. They're wonderful people. He said in Meeker County, Minnesota, where I was born, which the county seat is Litchfield, in the 1950 census, there was one, not two, but one black person in the entire county. But that didn't stop all the local Minnesotans from being instinctive experts on race relations. They used to lecture him all the time about how cruel and heartless and mean white Southerners were to blacks. He said he'd just shake his head and roll his eyes. He said it's like people that live in the desert presuming to tell people that live in the jungle about jungle survival techniques.
Well, folks in Minneapolis are getting education in race relations now.
But it's too late. See, that was a stroke of genius on the part of the left to make their initial offensive against the American society and civilization on civil rights, because it split the white population down the middle, the whites, the Southerners versus the Northerners. And of course, it was very cheap absolution for the white Northerners. I said, yeah, I'll be glad to, accept all the credit you want to give me about this. I'm all for you. We need to whip these Southerners into shape. And, it all started off with Brown as desegregation.
Mm-hmm.
Words, we're not going to make you integrate, but for example, if there's a little black child that lives across the street from a white school, they ought to be able to go across the street to that school rather than go across town to go to a black school.
Mm-hmm.
But then within 20 years, they were busing white kids into black neighborhoods and black kids into white neighborhoods to get racial balance. So
yeah. In the north of all, like Boston. Yeah.
Yeah. And see, when that happened, people out of the north said, oh, shit. OK, this is what this is what it's all coming to. But, you know, they couldn't do anything about it now because this whole movement had, you know, developed this momentum, you know, like it, you know, a new life in and of itself. And they couldn't do anything to stop it, even when they realized that, you know, it's like they say in the South, they stopped preaching and started meddling. And that's what happened. But, you know, then nobody could do anything about it. And see, what happened was people in the North said, you know, if we do away with segregation laws, and if we just treat these people a little bit better, maybe they will basically just rise up and be just indistinguishable from white people. Well, people in the South knew that wasn't going to work. In fact, if anything, race relations are much worse now because of the civil rights movement, black achievement, black intelligence on standardized tests and stuff like this have gone in the tank. They were basically making progress before. During segregation, and I grew up in it, there were a lot of black entrepreneurs in the black neighborhoods. They would have dry cleaning stores. They would have convenience stores. They would have insurance agencies, things like this. But that's because back in the days of segregation, all strata, the black upper class, middle class, lower class, all lived in the same neighborhood. And the upper and middle classes weren't going to allow themselves to live in a criminally, you know, dominated chaos. So they worked with the police and they had, you know, neighborhoods that were safe and clean and orderly. Look at a picture, for example, of black guys on the street corner in 1950 and compare it with a picture of black guys now with their pants down, you know, pants showing and tattoos and whatnot, all this type of stuff over compared with... You know, back then they were wearing zoot suits and stuff like that, but everybody was neat as a pin and whatnot. And they were, you know, they were trying to impress white people. They were basically trying to assimilate into white pop and white standards and mores.
Yeah, white people were told that if segregation, these Jim Crow barriers were lifted, that blacks would become aspiring middle class and abide by the rules. Sidney Poitier's, you know, right?
Yeah, right. Well, see, white Southerners knew that was a load of rubbish, okay? And they knew it wasn't going to work, but nobody would listen to us.
And didn't you see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Yeah, oh, sure. Well, you notice that there was a whole cadre of people in Hollywood that decided that the golden road to wealth and, you know, celebrity was to kiss Jewish ass, okay? And that's what they did. That, for example, Frank Sinatra made that little short movie right after World War II, The Street I Live On. We had something about it on the political cesspool. You can look a couple of weeks back. And basically, he and people like Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, Sterling Hayden, whatnot like this, they decided that, you know, if you can't lick them, join them. So they decided they were going to be out-liberal the liberal Jews. And Hollywood people that didn't go that way, like Charlton Heston or John Voight and Mel Gibson, people like that, you know, they're basically untouchables and became that way. You can't, you know, that's Jewish power and influence at work. And, you know, they they controlled the media. They controlled the publishing industry. You were talking about To Kill a Mockingbird. Interesting story about that. Harper Lee, a native Southerner, wrote a book and sent it to one of these big publishing houses up in New York.
New York, publishing a book about the South, yeah.
Yeah, just happened to run into a Jewish editor up there. And the Jewish editor did a total rewrite on it. Harper Lee had written the book basically from a Southern white viewpoint. The Jewish editor rewrote it into this Jewish parable on race relations. Harper Lee complained, and the editor said, if you know it's good for you, shut your mouth. Well, she did. She didn't publish anything else during her lifetime.
No.
Because of that, she lived on those royalties for the rest of her life, okay? You had the same thing with John Grisham.
Oh, yes, the A Time to Kill.
Look, he actually worked in the law firm I worked with,
That story's great.
I mean, this is just crazy. But see what happened was, it says on the thing, you know, it's a book about this, you know, sweet virginal old black 12-year-old girl who's walking home minding her own business when a bunch of knuckleheaded Klansmen, you know, missing links, pulls her over to the side, rapes her, beats her up, kills her or something, I think.
Leaves her for dead. She doesn't die, yeah.
Yeah, she doesn't die. And I think, who is it? Samuel L. Jackson was
plays the father, yeah.
And Matthew McConaughey is the white savior lawyer who's mm-hmm. going to protect him. See, he decides these guys are going to get off, so does he kill one or... Yep.
He shoots them when they're being arraigned or something and ends up being on trial for shooting the two men and then injuring a deputy, I think. Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey specializes in the roles just like Spencer Tracy did, you know, for an earlier generation. But anyway... It says on the book, this is his first book, based on a true story, and it was. A true story, the races were reversed. I know because another guy in our firm was a part-time public defender, and he represented Willie Earle, a black guy that broke into a white family's house. The parents were gone, had a 16-year-old girl and a 12-year-old girl in there. The 16-year-old was taking a shower. He breaks in, rapes her, beats her up.
Mm-hmm.
Tries to kill them both, but the best thing he could find was one of those, you know, prong forks that you use out on the barbecue grill, and he mm-hmm. couldn't apparently cause enough loss of blood to kill them, but he leaves them there. Well, this guy that I knew was the guy that defended Willie Earle, and he said the guy was cruel as hell. He was a bastard and all this type of stuff. But, see, again... You know, the big lie is told. Yeah, it was based on a true story, but basically it's a blood libel against Southern white people.
Mm-hmm.
Just like To Kill a Mockingbird is too, okay? But, you know, you'll find white Gentiles that are willing to sell out their own kind for money. They're corruptible. So are black people. So are just about every other person. And that's how Jewish power and influence comes to rule the day, you know. Money talks and BS walks, as they say. And as a Southern lawyer friend of mine said, money's honey, Sonny, and a rich man's jokes are always funny.
Well, that's the thing with the racial narrative or the racial ideology is it portrays white people as the oppressor, as the offender, the ones that are guilty, and blacks as the victim, innocent and oppressed. And so when you're dealing with something like street crime, rape statistics, murder rates and these things and black on white crime, that can't be reconciled. You know, how that may indeed affect racial relations, where people decide to live and where they go to school. To them, it's always why you may want a little bit of separation is because you're just a racist, as opposed to you just want to get away from all the crime and all the problems that are a reality in the black community for any number of reasons, you know, that we can talk about, you know. So,
well, they'll talk about everything. It's a Democrat-run city, for example, all that type of baloney. Nobody will call a spade a dirty shovel, as my wife's used to say, okay? these people, look, what you saw in the Tyree Nichols situation is this brutality in the black race that we've all known was there from the beginning. You do not want to be ruled over by black people if you're white, because, you know, you don't see white cops going out and intentionally beating up blacks. See, the thing is, the left is trying to foment a race war. They've been doing that since the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, you know, Emmett Till, they love Emmett Till. They love Dylann Roof. But people like Emmett Till and Dylann Roof are kind of like Halley's Comet. They fly through the atmosphere about once every 75 years.
Yeah.
You can't base a widespread movement based on this assumption that white people are wantonly and cruelly killing you on a regular basis. The only way they can get any type of mass of numbers of black people dying at the hands of white people is in police work. So that's what they have focused on. Okay. And even then, you know, it just doesn't play out. But that's why they're doing that. You know, they want to have you.
Well, any given year, you'll have 2,000 blacks murdering each other. Well, and, you'll have a dozen police shootings that may be questionable.
There's about, you know, the same number of blacks killed by blacks, or let's say black murders generally and white murders, okay? Mm-hmm. But when you consider that whites are 57% of the population, blacks are 13%, to have equal numbers, blacks are doing a hell of a lot more than their share, yep. Okay? And that's at the best situation from their standpoint. It's really even a lot worse than that right now. You know, black people are killing each other right, left, and sideways. And they don't know. See, they've now crossed another psychological barrier with Tyre Nichols. Now it doesn't matter that the black guy was killed by five black people. It's still white racism that is responsible for these deaths. Somehow, you know, white people have gotten some type of magical, mystical, supernatural powers that makes blacks behave like the Ku Klux Klan. And of course, this is all total baloney, okay? These things just, you know, whites wantonly killing blacks just doesn't happen, okay? It never happened very much anytime. You know, they make the big thing about lynchings. Between 1865 and 1965, the numbers were like about 3,000 to 4,000. That's an average year in Chicago, okay? Yeah. You know, nobody will tell them that, you know, this idea that we need to pull down all these Confederate monuments and make a statue to some guy that happened to be, you know, killed and hauled out of jail probably because he was guilty of sin. You know, they don't tell you about that.
Well, they think it's the To Kill a Mockingbird narrative, right?
Well, yeah. Every black person that was ever lynched, and by the way, Emmett Till wasn't a lynching, it was a killing, okay? A lynching is when you take somebody out and hang them, okay? But nonetheless, it just, you know, it doesn't happen. It's a very rare event. For example, Leo Frank. The Jews at least have created this narrative about the Holocaust and 6 million Jews being killed by Germans. Mm-hmm. Two groups of white people who are most hated and beyond redemption are Germans and white Southerners.
Yeah, and they're often conflated, oddly enough.
Yeah, and on the other hand, what can they point to? As
80 years separates them.
Well, it was the ADL that was created because of Leo Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Leo Frank was a Jewish guy that owned a factory. There was a 12-year-old white Gentile girl named Mary Fagan who was coming in to get her last paycheck. He raped her and killed her.
He was a Jewish carpetbagger, right?
Yeah, right. And he tried to put it off in the trial on a black guy, but the white Southerners weren't fool, they knew who did it. Also, World Jewry put their combined might behind defending him. They hired the best lawyers. They got all sorts of money raised and whatnot like this. And when it didn't work, they eventually got to the governor of Georgia, corrupted him, paid him off, and he was going to pardon Leo Frank. And when the people in the town found out that was in the works, they were so outraged, they stormed the jail, took Leo Frank out, and did hang him. Okay. Mm-hmm. But that's one person. But see,
he was duly convicted, appeals yeah. exhausted. The issue was the governor had issued a clemency, and I guess this was like they figured it was eventually they were going to release him, so they weren't going to let him get away with it.
Yeah. Well, they knew what was going on.
Yeah. Okay?
And what happened was, you know, it's a. They have these things called Noahide laws where they basically think Jews ought to be able to get away with killing mm-hmm. or otherwise committing criminal acts against Gentiles.
Yeah, I think Leo Frank was the head of the local B'nai B'rith chapter. Yeah. Yeah.
And see, another thing is, you know, you don't hear much about it now, but the Loeb Leopold murders, where two Jewish privileged guys decided, what would it feel like to kill one of these, you know, white Gentile guys? So they got a 12-year-old kid and killed him. And they had this big trial. Clarence Darrow, people think that, you know, he was this hero of, you know, Inherit the Wind.
And, yeah.
They forget that basically Clarence Darrow won that trial. But not Clarence Darrow, I mean that William Jennings Bryan won that trial.
That's right, yes.
Clarence Darrow, though, really became the sweetheart of the Jewish community by defending Loeb and Leopold in the Loeb-Leopold murders from around Chicago. And I think he wound up getting their lives saved and whatnot. But nonetheless, see, it's like the Rosenbergs, you know, the spies that stole the nuclear, the atom bomb plans and sold them to the Russians. And, you know, they're still in places like the Upper West Side and New York and whatnot. These people, you know, will maintain that the Rosenbergs were innocent when after the fall of the Soviet Union, we got a hold of the Venona cables that showed that they were guilty as homemade sin.
Yeah, and that's, you see that even with Susan Rosenberg. I don't know if they're related. She's related to the Rosenbergs, but she was a terrorist who planted a bomb outside, I think it was Senator Byrd's office in 1983, and exploded it. And she went to prison for doing that. She got caught. And then she was pardoned by Clinton at the urging of, what's his name, the Congress from New York. He's Jewish.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden...
somebody like that.
If you're a Jewish terrorist, that you should be pardoned. And it's similar, of course, with... with the spy that Trump pardoned.
Jonathan Pollard.
Jonathan Pollard, where he sells secrets to the Soviet Union, our arch enemy, supposedly in the Cold War. He's caught, goes to prison, sentenced to life in prison. For decades, the Jewish lobbies for his pardoning. He eventually gets pardoned because of Sheldon Adelson's bidding. And he's flown over on his jet, and he's treated like a hero, met like a hero in Tel Aviv by Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, if Israel is indeed our ally and our friend, why is a traitor to America being treated as a hero in Israel? Because he's Jewish. So what that means is that Jews think the fact that Jonathan Pollard is Jewish matters more than he's an American. So what does that suggest?
It's called Noahide laws.
Look, yeah.
Noahide. And, well, for example, look at Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump in his last days is, you know, pardoning rappers and every Jewish guy that
yes.
Gary Kushner's team. Meanwhile, the silence is deafening about any aid at all for the people that at his urging went to the Capitol on January the 6th.
Yes.
He won't give them the sweat off his balls.
Okay? You peacefully protest what you believe is a fraudulent election. You're called an insurrectionist and a terrorist, and you spend 10 years in prison or denied a trial, solitary confinement.
But and the guy you do it for won't lift a finger to help you, but he'll help these black, you know, rappers and, left-wing lunatics and then all these Jewish criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Epstein, people like this. Jonathan Pollard. See... it's, we've got the best government the money can buy, and it doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat, you know, it's, money talks and BS walks, like I said. And see, we've got to understand what type of situation we're in now. You know, we've got everything that the civil rights movement was staged and manufactured. And you can tell that America has gone in the toilet as a civilization since the Civil Rights Movement. Public education in 1954, when the Brown decision came down, was number one in the world. Now it's number 38 at the bottom of the first world.
Oh, now they're even, like in Virginia, in Northern Virginia, the schools didn't issue merit scholarship awards because there weren't enough blacks and Hispanics getting it.
Yeah, well, see, the thing is...
there's lawsuits now because of this.
See... I was born in the first one-third of the boomer generation, and I was unfortunate enough to be one of the first victims of affirmative action. A lot of people suspect they were. I know that I was, and the way I know it is this. When I went to college, I had a work-study job in the college registrar's office. What mm-hmm. did the college registrar do? Well, the college registrar handled everyone's transcript. If somebody was applying to to a professional school, a medical school, a law school, a graduate school, or was trying to transfer laterally to another college or university. Their application would come through my office. I would fish out their transcript. And because I had their transcript, I knew what their course of study was, their grade point average was, their standardized test scores, all of that stuff, okay? All their, you know, academic and non-academic achievements, whether they were on this team or whether they got this award, that and the other. I had it all. And when I was a senior, I noticed that a black senior that I knew was applying to Vanderbilt Law School. That's where I wanted to go. In Memphis at the time, going to Vanderbilt Law School, that was a gold standard. If you wanted a job with a silk stocking or what they call a white shoe law firm, you went to Vanderbilt. If you went to Harvard or Yale, people would say, what are you doing in Memphis? If you went to any other law school like Ole Miss or Tennessee or Arkansas or the University of Memphis or whatnot, basically you just got your ticket punched. You could run in the race, but you didn't have any inside track for partnership or something like that. Well, I had a 3.64 out of 4.0 grade point average and was Phi Beta Kappa. This guy had below a 2.4 grade point average, this black guy that was applying to Vanderbilt like me. I had a 170 out of a potential 180 on the LSAT, Law School Aptitude Test. He had below a 150. Guess who got into Vanderbilt Law School and who didn't even get put on the waiting list?
Well, as a matter of equity.
Well, the thing is,
yeah,
I got shut out. He got in. And see, this was 1973, so this crap has been going on a long, long time. Hopefully, it's about to come to an end, but you're going to have to do what the left did. They created a federal agency called the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, to enforce the 64 Civil Rights Act. And that's where they came up with affirmative action as being the enforcement strategy of the EEOC while it was under the control of Alfred Bloom Rosen. Guess what his ethnicity is?
Okay. Now, this is funny because when they passed the 64 Civil Rights Act, I think it was a Minnesotan, the Senator Hubert Humphrey, who said, protested because there were people who said, if you read the law, I can see this is going to lead to racial quotas and so-called affirmative action, reverse discrimination, if you will. And they said, well, no. And Hubert Humphrey said, if it does, I'll eat the law. I'll eat the bills as well. A few years later, they imposed it. Yeah. And they also said this 1965 Immigration Act wouldn't change the country's demographics.
Yeah, that was Ted Kennedy. And then...
yeah, they lie about both these things. So.
The reason we have electoral fraud now is because of the Voting Rights Act of 65. See, they used the Mississippi burning murders. And again, that was not two white guys and a black guy. It was two Jews from New York and a white guy. Mm-hmm. And a black guy from down south. Basically, white Southerners and black Southerners get along famously unless there is a third-party agent provocateur involved in the mix to stir things up between them.
Mm-hmm.
During the first Reconstruction, those provocateurs were Yankee abolitionists. In the second Reconstruction, which was the Civil Rights Movement, it was Jewish freedom riders like Swerner and Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
And see, they don't tell you the stories behind that. They don't tell you that Swerner was publishing and distributing a book in comic book format telling blacks how to go about killing white people, okay? But that was known to the people in Neshoba County at the time. For example, they talk about
I didn't see that in Mississippi Burning. They didn't talk about that.
Of course not. They're not going to talk about that.
But they do feature an FBI agent bringing in a black guy to threaten to torture a white Southerner, and we're supposed to think that's okay.
Yeah, and well, then the other thing, remember the 14th Street or 16th Street Baptist Church bombing where the four little girls?
Mm-hmm.
Most criminal act ever. You know, it beats the 18 people killed by Nelson Mandela in South Africa at the Prince's Street train station,
mm-hmm.
or Rahm Emanuel's father, who is the head of the Irgun and masterminded the bombing of the King David Hotel, where they put dynamite in kegs of nails to maximize damage, and they killed 120 white Gentiles, basically.
Well, you never want a good crisis go to waste, as Rahm Emanuel says, right?
Yeah, that's right, and that's what he did. But see, on the other hand, you know, these four girls were the most important people in the world, just like Emmett Till. You know, forget about all these other people. Emmett Till is, you know, the most important person since Jesus Christ.
Well, wasn't that bombing eventually tied back to an FBI informant?
Well, it was, but see, they always had that. The big problem in the South during the Civil Rights Movement is that the Klan was put to the forefront by the FBI, and the reason they were so vulnerable is, see, they should have left things to the White Citizens Council, which were the top strata of white society in these southern towns, like the bankers, the lawyer, the doctor,
yeah, stuff. The Atticus Finches.
Yeah, and see, those people, if for example, a black guy came and decided he was going to head up a voter registration drive, guess what? He wouldn't be employable in the town anymore. He's using the same type of tactics they use against us now. Mm-hmm. But instead, they would go to the the working class, lower middle class Klan, where they, you know, the guy said, well, what you gonna do about it? What you gonna, you know, in other words, you know, trying to provoke people to violence. And then when they did, the problem with them was they had a lot of lower level criminals in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd go up to a guy and say, well, Stanley Joe, we know that you burglarized Farmer Jones's barn last February. You know, you can go to Parchman for 7 years for that, boy. Said, but if you'll play ball with us, we'll make sure that nobody ever knows about that. And that's how they got all this insider information on what was going on. But see, what happened at that bombing was these guys put the bomb in an exit, you know, a fire exit. It's supposed to be no admittance, emergency exit only. And they thought it would blow up, blow a hole in the wall, break some glasses, and scare people. They weren't planning on four little girls playing hooky from Sunday school going in that fire exit to smoke and being there when the bomb went off, okay? So, you know.
So just bad luck.
Well, bad luck. But again, you know, you would think these are the most bloodthirsty killers.
Here's the thing. If Susan Rosenberg had planted a bomb, you know, in Congress, and there happened to be some tourist walking by, or congressional, you know, three or four young congressional pages walking by and murdered, okay, that very easy just could have happened then. That's why you don't plant bombs.
Yeah. Well, look at what happened to those guys in the Birmingham church bombing compared to Kathy Bowden and David Gilbert.
Mm-hmm.
They actually put a bomb in the Capitol. They didn't just show up at the Capitol like the people in January 6th. They put a bomb in there, caused $200,000 worth of damage. They also were involved in the robbery of a Brinks truck in which two Brinks guards were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kathy Bowden came from a very prominent Jewish family. Her father, I think her grandfather, was one of the founders of the National Lawyers Guild, which is one of the groups they used along with NAACP Legal Defense Fund in these mocked up so-called spontaneous civil rights movement demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they would have a busload of National Lawyer Guild and NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyers showing up there at the same time with stacks of bail money, okay? And they were ready to get them out in a thrice, okay? That's what they did. And nobody was doing that for Bobby Frank Cherry and all these other people. And meanwhile, when it came to Kathy Bowden, she got out of jail very shortly afterwards.
Well, look at Billy Ayers and Bourdain Dorn. They never saw the day in jail.
They raised Chase Bowden, who was Kathy Bowden and David Gilbert's child.
Yes, the former prosecutor out in San Francisco.
Yeah. Sam Francis wrote a very good article about him back in the early 2000s and about how even though he had dyslexia, he was going to Harvard and Yale and law school, and he'd gone to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar and whatnot. He had the royal road to, having a wonderful career for all of this stuff. And see, I don't think anybody did that for Bobby Frank Cherry's children. You know, they're probably living in a some type of old mobile home down by the river or something in the junkyard or something. But see, this is why there's no down for that. Bill Ayers and Bernadette Dorn raised Chase Abodin. Bill Ayers was one that did that bombing on the Capitol. But guess what? How is he punished? He's let out of jail and becomes the head of public education in the state of Illinois. Okay?
Yeah, and he trains Barack Obama, right?
Exactly. He was one of the guys that, picked him out as, a likely comer and whatnot. See, even Obama agrees. He said that he was an average student at Occidental College, and then suddenly Cornel West and Bill Ayers get involved, and he's transferring to Columbia, one of the top three Ivies, and it's the one that has the most Jews in it because it's the one that's in Manhattan in the Upper West Side. Okay? Like, Andrew Goodman of the, Mississippi Burning Three, his father was a wealthy Upper West Side lawyer that, along with Zero Mostel, used to hold fundraisers, society fundraisers, to raise money for the Rosenbergs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Mickey Schwerner was more of a, middle-class Jew, but he was, likewise, he was just as far to the left as you could possibly be. And they are just supposedly these little idealistic college students that are showing up there to, help the poor black people gain their rights.
And I suppose there's no problems in New York that need to be solved first, right?
Oh, no. Well, they came down. See, they always come down.
Yeah.
That's why they always used to talk about outside agitators during the civil rights movement. And they made fun of that. Oh, man, that shows what a hick you are to say that. Well, that's exactly what they were, outside agitators. That's a perfect description of them. And that's what they did.
Well, the South is kind of portrayed as sort of a benighted, a backward, tyrannical,
violent thing. Well, basically, yeah. See, all of that, it's amazing. And see, that they always had one big event to precede a legislative initiative, like Mississippi Burning.
Mm-hmm.
Legislative initiative that followed was the 64 Civil Rights Act. The Selma Bridge incident, well, what followed that was the Voting Rights Act of 65, which was basically a transformation of law, election law, to facilitate black electoral fraud.
Yeah, which is rampant now. It's the norm. Yeah.
See, what they did was they realized that they might get black people the right to vote, but they still weren't going to win elections because black people couldn't make themselves get up on election day and between 8 in the morning and 7 in the evening show up at a specific place, their polling off place, and with a picture ID or a official ID like a driver's license and vote.
Yeah.
So they had all this elaborately expanded early voting. And if you're in the a place like Memphis, all the early voting things, I mean, 4 out of 5 are going to be in black neighborhoods.
Yeah, it's the basic, you can mobilize the riffraff vote. The idea is if you create some sort of expectation of responsible behavior to make people actually show up at a designated time and vote, you're guaranteeing the people voting are people who have higher agency, presumably more responsibility. Yeah.
That's trying to force your honky ways on them, and that just won't do it. And then the other thing is you had absentee voting without purpose, without any reason. And see what happens in the black churches is the pastor will say, well, Miss Viola is sitting out there with a card table in the vestibule with a stack of, absentee ballots. You just fill it out, sign your name, we'll make sure it gets voted right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's why, see, when they decided to start stealing elections for real was with the Norm Thompson, Al Franken election in Minnesota to fill the position vacated by the death of Paul Wellstone, who was Jewish,
mm-hmm.
was one of the senators from Minnesota. Al Franken, of course, is Jewish too. Norm Thompson was the Republican. Well, Norm Thompson won it, but then they said, well, recount, recount. So all of a sudden, some black ministers found.
Was it Thompson or Coleman?
It may have been Coleman. I don't know. It was
Norm something. I think it was Coleman.
It was some white bread dude that was as spineless as could be. And basically, they kept finding, some black minister would find in the trunk of his car, 10,000 votes.
Yes.
And, they kept pulling them out as many as they wanted, just like they did in the 2020 election. You know, remember when they finding all these things? And see, they don't really even have to go into the voting machines and all that. Of course, if the voting machine doesn't have a paper trail, then it's an invitation to vote fraud. But they don't have to do it because all of these key swing states have large black metropolises in there, like Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.
Detroit, Michigan, and
Detroit, Michigan, and things like that. Or Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what they can do is they can just get these absentee ballots. I remember when I was running for office one time, my mother's in a nursing home. I wanted to get her, this for the 2016 election, a absentee ballot. They would only give me one. I said, well, can I have two in case we mess one up? No, you can just have one. And then the next line, this black one was there. She got 50. I said, well, what's up? What the hell's up with this? I said, oh, well, she's the preacher. She's the secretary for, Reverend Cleophas High Stepper at the, the Greater Beulah Land Anointing Temple or what, something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And they give them to them, and they, they just harvest ballots. That's what they do. And the whole thing is corrupt as hell. If you call a halt to it, you're going to lose your job. So
people, you'd be called a racist worse, right? You're called a racist.
Oh, yeah, right. You might as well just jump off the bridge if they do that.
Voter suppression is like requiring IDs, so you...
Yeah, but please don't call me a racist. How about pedophile? Okay, or pedophile murderer, maybe. Anything except a racist, right?
Well, I mean, half of the white people, they'll be put on the edge of a pit where everyone's being shot and thrown in the body, and just before, the Czechist fires the bullet in his head, any last request? Yeah, don't call me racist.
Just remember this. I may be a bad person, but I'm not a racist.
But I'm not a racist.
See, it's like a Stalinist show trial. That's what they do. They protest their innocence, but the more they do it, it's not going to gain them any dispensation whatsoever.
No.
They don't understand that. And, Republicans are just the most spineless bunch of, wimps.
Well, speaking of like affirmative action and the law, I just saw a segment on Tucker Carlson where he's dog whistling again. He says, I think 95 or 96 judicial appointments have been made by the Biden administration. Five or six are white men. I presume they're probably Jewish. And 22 are women of color.
Well, if you notice that every major city in America now has a black woman as a police chief.
Yes, and of course, that works out well, doesn't it? Like Memphis, but there's an interesting exchange. What is this? It was here we go. Yes, it was last January. There was a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, and Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana. You gotta love him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love his southern drawl, the way he asks. It's like the old days. Well, he's questioning a Chanel Blankengren, I think I have pronounced that name. She's a nominee to the U.S. District Court judge for the U.S. East District of Washington. Let me play this, because he's asking her just the fundamentals of constitutional law, and you might get a kick out of this.
I think I've heard it, but go ahead and play
it. I'll play it, yeah.
Yeah.
So where is this? Let me... Here we go.
Thank you, Senator Booker, Senator Kennedy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations to all of you. Judge, on the far end, tell me what Article 5 of the Constitution does.
Article 5 is not coming to mind at the moment.
Okay. How about Article 2?
Neither is Article 2.
Okay. Do you know what percussivism is?
In my 12 years as an assistant attorney general and my 9 years serving as a judge, I was not faced with that precise question. We are the highest trial court in Washington state, so I'm frequently faced with issues that I'm not familiar with, and I thoroughly review the law, our research, and apply the law to the facts presented to me.
Well, you're going to be faced with it as a, if you're confirmed. I can assure you of that.
Okay. You hear that?
Yeah, I heard it. It's just, you know, what did I do for those 12 years? Well, I was an affirmative action hire, and they gave me the simplest, the easiest cases they had.
Now, Article 5 deals with the state's power to call a convention of the states to propose amendments. Article 2 deals with the executive branch, basically the president, vice president, and the executive officers. I knew that. Purposivism I had to look up, but it's basically, you can figure it out. It's a theory of statutory interpretation whereby courts strive to interpret statutory provisions in accordance with the state statute's purpose. That makes sense. But you would think someone, a constitutional scholar, presumably that's what judges are supposed to be, would know that. And she's being appointed to the bench. She doesn't know these basic – she doesn't know Constitutional Law 101, but she doesn't care about the Constitution, does she?
No, look, this is all affirmative action. Affirmative action in the judiciary will result in ignorant judges making decisions on bases other than stare decisis.
Like Brown versus Board of Education, right?
Yeah, that. And then on the other hand – in business, you're going to get incompetent people in charge of businesses that are more interested in being politically correct than making a, you know, that's why black people like government jobs. That's a real job. They don't want to be bedeviled with pesky concepts like profitability and productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you're going to see America's businesses start to falter. You're going to see our government become more corrupt, less of, you know, running the way it was supposed to by the founding fathers. And American society is going down the tubes, okay? That's what is happening as a result of promoting less able people and giving up on meritocracy.
Well, it's a war on human capital, isn't it?
And see, it'd be really easy once the Supreme Court knocks down affirmative action to defend it, because all you have to do is read the exact language of the 64 Civil Rights Act, which says that you shall not discriminate on the basis of race, period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's white on black or black on white or whatever, you know, type of discrimination. Anything based on race is prohibited. But, you know, we've had so much lying and so much basically Jewish shenanigans in our government, in our judiciary, in our businesses now. You have people like Larry Fink of Vanguard.
BlackRock, I mean.
Yeah, BlackRock, excuse me, and Vanguard. Yeah. What are they? They are holding companies.
Yes.
They basically own stock in other places. So they can tell FedEx, you have to hire an Indian to be your president, which they did. Of course, Fred Smith still makes all the decisions, but they had to give somebody this honorary title to keep Larry Fink from going forward and boycotting them and putting them out of business.
Mm-hmm.
See, we have a corrupt society, and all the corruption comes from the left. And who is the most leftist group of people? Jewish power and influence. Mm-hmm. See, it's very easy.
Well, I've summed it up this way, is that when John Adams said that our system of government, our Constitution, relies on or presumes the existence of a moral people. In the absence of a moral people, it doesn't work. But if you have a group under the guise of progressivism or liberalism, liberation, or undermining the morality of the people, which the Jews are primarily responsible for, the system's not going to work anymore.
Yeah, they're not the moral people. They're not, you know, basically, they, if you read the Talmud, they think that they can commit crimes against Gentiles and Gentiles should have no recourse.
Yeah, progressivism is you can, what it is it's sort of warmed over Talmudism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And see, the Talmud is much more important. That's what they go to yeshiva for. It's not to learn the Torah. You know, the first five books of the Old Testament or anything, it's learn the Talmud. And the Talmud, I mean, it has articles in there that absolutely would shock all these Christian fundamentalists that think that, you know, these are God's chosen people. And I forget who the English author was who said, how odd of God to choose the Jews, you know. But see, this is...
Well, that's obsolete anyway with the crucifixion, so...
Yeah, well, that's what they call replacement theology. They were the chosen people before the coming of Christ. And when Christ came and they decided not to follow him, as my Sunday school teacher taught me in the Episcopal Church back when I was a child, he said, if you don't follow Christ, you're no longer the chosen person. You are our people. You're lost as a Hottentot, as he said. And see, this is what we have. We have a liberalism has become synonymous in our churches with Christian righteousness. And it's just the opposite. Actually, and all of this sexual depravity as a civil right is really bringing this into focus for people. But basically, liberalism is the modern face of evil. Everything that is evil is something that the left is promoting now. And they've basically taken off any disguise, any... effort to, you know, camouflage their true intention. It's just coming out, and they're going to shove it down your throat and make you like it. And if you don't go along with it, we're going to ruin your career. We're going to ruin, they're going to try to get hate speech in and put you in jail for having an opinion. You saw that proposed law by Sheila Jackson Lee. That basically would make it a hate crime for you to say anything that is against any other group or could be construed as being negative towards any other group other than white Gentiles. And if they can cause you to lose your job, they can cause you to go to jail. In fact, you know, the World Economic Council, there's this woman named Valerie Jornka or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get hate speech laws in America, and she said, and yes, you will have them soon. And everybody was a wink and a nod. There's these knowing laughs in the group up there. This is what they have in mind for us.
Yeah, that's the Leading Against White Supremacy Act of 2023.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing about it is people like Sheila Jackson Lee or Jonathan Greenblatt's ADL, they are anti-American. They should not be entrusted with any power, because if anything, but America, where we're told that America is a proposition nation, we have certain political creeds that define us as Americans, and one of that, of course, is free speech. So if you violate free speech, you don't believe in free speech anymore, you have essentially forfeited your claim to be an American.
Well, see, that's one of those Jewish lies that they have been able to postulate uncritically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for example, you know, that's a load of rubbish. You know, read the Founding Fathers, read John Jay in Federalist Number 2 about the Band of Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And they have no respect for the founders. They will try to use constitutional principles like they did in Brown versus Board of Education when it serves their purposes. But they're like Vilfredo Pareto, the famous Italian socialist in the 19th century, who said that when I am weak, I ask you for equality and fairness because those are your principles.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm strong, I deny equality and fairness to you because that is my principle.
Yeah, so it's a friend-enemy distinction.
Right. That's all it comes down to. Yeah. You know, if you think that they are principled, you know, then see me after the meeting. There's a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they could invoke free speech at Berkeley or in the 60s in the name of liberty or radicalism or these things when they were tearing institutions down or taking them over. But once they're in power, they impose speech codes and hate speech laws and violate free speech.
I was watching one of these things from the Civil Rights Movement where this sanctimonious Mike Wallace, you know, good Scotsman like William Wallace, James Eastland, trying to put him down. Well, actually, Mike Wallace is Jewish. His real name is Myron Wolek, okay? Mm-hmm. And see, that they will lie and lie and lie some more, and they will hide their antecedents. They don't want people to, you know, that's why, you know, the one big secret they don't want out is just the pervasiveness of their power and influence. Look at all the Jewish people that are in the Biden administration, for example. Mm-hmm. Look at this war that we're having in Ukraine right now. Mm-hmm. Russians, they love that because that's two white Gentile nations killing one another off, and they'd like nothing more than for it to go nuclear so that you'll complete the kill off of white Gentiles by getting the rest of Europe and America, killed off. And of course, they're white nations, at least perceived as white nations by most other nations in the world. And this is, you know, and what are they trying to get by this? I remember early on in the war hearing Sebastian Gorka, remember him on mm-hmm. radio? He said, please contribute money to the Council of Christians and Jews so that we can send needed supplies to the poor Ukrainians. We're going to send them blankets and food and whatnot. Well, that's good as far as it went, but the real purpose was to get an empty airplane in the Ukraine after they unloaded all those blankets and food, and they exclusively flew out of Ukraine Ukrainian Jews to go to Israel, okay? Now, also, we're supposed to be the home for refugees. We've basically turned all of Ukraine into a nation of refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. How many white Ukrainian refugees have you seen wandering around your town? I hadn't seen a damn one of them here in Memphis, okay? This is the way it is. You know, it's, you know, they just... they've got this agenda which doesn't vary, and it's just as predictable as that the sun will rise in the east and set in the west. They may be for refugees, but they sure don't, you know, for some reason, they just forgot about all these white refugees coming from Ukraine. The last thing they want is to bring white people to America, okay?
Yeah, they'd rather import North Africans or people from the Horn of Africa or... people in Afghanistan, put them in Maine or Minnesota,
And you can never mention Jews. You know, they said, well, who's this group that is responsible for bringing all these problems to America? It's those damned Eskimos, right?
Well, yeah, you can never identify them as a group unless you're writing a reparations check or something. Someone's got to cash it, right?
Yeah, I tell you what, it's something else.
Well, we've been going for over 2 hours, as I predicted.
it's been fun. I tell you what, it's just been freewheeling, and it's
You could probably go on for another 2 hours until we passed out. So, where can people follow your work?
You can go to thepoliticalcesspool.org. We have a pretty good website. We have daily updates and stuff like this. We're Southern, Christian, and paleoconservative, okay? Those are our three hallmarks, and we've carved out a niche for ourselves with that. And I think, we've really been successful. We're the only group really on the, what do you call, the dissident right that is not just on the internet. We have a presence on terrestrial radio. And that peeves the bejeebers out of the left, but there's nothing they can do about it because we've got a good radio station or group of radio stations that do it. So we're actually in terrestrial radio. But see, that's why, for example, the internet's the best thing that ever happened to our movement because that's the only way we can get the word out before, the old Saul used to be, don't get in an argument with someone who buys ink by the barrel. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Jewish power and influence did. They controlled the media, ABC, NBC, CBS. They controlled all these newspapers. They would, you know, buy up local newspapers in the South. And the first thing they'd do is fire the editor, and then they'd bring in some editor from out of the area. And basically you'd find that the newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi has the same editorial policy as the newspaper in Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They can try, you know, money talks. And this is what happened. This is the way they control things. That's the way they've always controlled things since the Middle Ages. And, you know, somehow we've got to find some way to counter that. Right now, freedom of speech plus, excuse me, the internet seems to be, you know, the reason we're making headway. See, it was so frustrating back in the days of the Civil Rights Movement to make better arguments, but never see them, you know, they're all smothered in the cradle.
Mm-hmm.
You never got them out, and you said, you know, we can't, what's wrong with this? And we knew that, first of all, the whole thing was going to be a disaster for America, and it has been, and for the West generally. And it's time for somebody to tell the emperor he has no clothes. And that's what we're trying to do, and we're doing it effectively. But, you know, the older generations of people right now, you know, they're used to turning on the TV. They're not very adept on surfing the net. And that's what our problem is. But, you know, basically all we have to do is have freedom of speech. If you let us get in a debate with the leftists, we'll win every damn time. Okay, that's just all there is to it. We've got the winning arguments. We've got right and truth on our side, and, you know, we know what worked. See, when I went to school, the public schools were great. Nobody worried about where you went to school. You didn't have to go to some special school, because wherever you went, if you had the aptitude for it, there was somebody there that could teach you calculus or physics or whatever, and if you made good grades in high school, you're prepared to do college level work, and you could depend on the public schools. See, everything that the left has done, integration of public schools, the feminist movement, the homosexual rights movement, the no-fault divorce initiative, everything like that has one common thread that runs through every last one of those radical egalitarian initiative. You know what that is?
The Jewish operations from start to finish.
That's one thing, but also the effect is reduction of white Gentile birth rates.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they want to do. You know, the thing is, they basically, that's why they're bringing in people from outside of the area. They thought at first that black people were going to mushroom in their population. When that didn't happen, that's when they decided to go overseas for reinforcements. And as somebody said one time, if you can't outfight them or outfox them, out F them, okay? That's what they want.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to try to do with racial strangers brought into our midst. You know,
yeah, and pornography and sexual degeneracy and just overall demoralization reduces the birth rate, the native birth rate. Then you can flood the country with.
That's right. Everything they do has that, you know, and for example, their vices. You know what the big vice of the day is now? Sports gambling. Think about it.
Yes, I've noticed that. It's been exploded.
It used to be that you couldn't even mention a sporting book line on a sports program. Now they have entire programs based on that.
They got a football team in Las Vegas.
Yeah, well, Las Vegas is a big place now. See, yeah. I worked for Holiday Inn. I got hired by their law department. I didn't know it, but I was part of the new wrecking crew.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Jews came in and made all the Christian fundamentalists walk the plank. The Christian fundamentalists that founded Holiday Inn were like Kemmons Wilson and Wallace E. Johnson. He had Boma Corporation, builder of men in homes. He was a big fundamentalist Christian. Well, they were plenty old hardscrabble businessmen, but they had a very good, righteous business plan. Kemmons Wilson had a large family, about 8, 9, 10 kids. he took him on a cross-country trip in the early 50s, and he was appalled at the quality of the accommodations that were available for traveling families.
Mm-hmm.
You would stop at what looked like a nice, new, clean motel and find out in the middle of the night it was part of the hot sheets trade. Or you would stop at a place and they wouldn't have anything for the kids to do. They didn't have a restaurant on site. You'd have to go rambling through some unfamiliar town, maybe get in a rough neighborhood, trying to find a place to eat. So I remember the ads to them. It went like this. Enjoy your vacation anywhere in the nation at a Holiday, Holiday Inn. You're assured of the best when you stop to rest at a Holiday, Holiday Inn. There's a soda pop and ice machine and more you see, a telephone in every room and free TV, a restaurant and a swimming pool, air-conditioned rooms to keep you real cool. See, my mind is full of all sorts of silliness like that, but it was a righteous idea. Well, Roy Weingartner was the number one franchisee holder in the whole organization. You got one vote for every motel you had, so he outvoted everyone else, made himself the head knocker. He had a more polished protege, went to Harvard, was about 6'7", was slim and trim, named Mike Rose. Well, they came in on the pretext that the old management was incompetent because they were losing money under the, effects of the first energy crisis, mm-hmm. 70s. So they made all these old Christian fundamentalist Gentiles walk the plank, took it over. But the real reason they did it was Mike Rose's father worked in Vegas, like a lot of other Jews. And he gave them insider information that gambling was going to be suddenly legal far beyond the boundaries of Nevada. So they're looking for a cash cow to kill. So they got involved in this. And I was the lawyer that sold off the unrelated parts of the business. They tried to disguise what they were doing. They called it going into the quote-unquote hospitality industry. They bought Perkins Cake and Steaks. You've seen Perkins restaurants and whatnot. But that mm-hmm. was basically camouflage. They were really getting into the gambling business. I went to Vegas when they bought 10% of the Riverboat Casino, a grind to learn the business. And I was there a year later when they bought Harrah's in Reno, okay? Bill Harrah was 58. He just married Bobby Gentry. You know who she was?
Yeah, the singer.
Ode to Billy Joe.
Ode to Billy Joe, yeah.
Yeah, she still lives in the Memphis area. She's kind of a recluse now, lives in a gated community, I understand. But nonetheless, that's what they did. They got all that in there, and they had all these Jewish guys like Chuck Solomson was a CFO and whatnot. I was flying in the jets with them all over the place, and it was something else, finding out, doing all this and seeing how they operated. But it was, I remember Mike Rose. One of my jobs was to sit in on board of directors meetings. If they had a legal question, I was there for a couple of them. I did that. And Mike Rose was about 6'7", but being Jewish wasn't very athletic. And during a break in one of the meetings, one of the outside directors asked him if he had ever played college basketball. And he said, no, he said, people didn't ask me questions like that all my life. He said, when I was a teenager, I used to try to slump over and, deflect questions like that, but it never worked. And I was about 5.5 feet tall. And I said, funny, it always worked for me. got a big laugh from everybody. But see, I was there. I didn't know what was going on, but that was part of a Jewish takeover using vice.
Yeah.
The gambling money. That's why they can now afford to pay every school in the SEC $65 million to get broadcast rights for them. That's just off the top, despite what they make based on Orbitron numbers and things like that. And that's why they get all that money. And they've got everybody who's a sports fan. If you want to be a swinging daddy-o, you got to be betting on all these sports. And they have shows telling you all these crazy parlays and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll lose more and more money. Okay.
And time.
It's just like Russia, you know, in the liquor industry in rural Russia in the 19th century. You know, they always, you know, they've got a script and they follow it to a letter. You know, they're going to use, they're going to basically get you involved in some type of vice, which will slake off your money. And they love it. You know, they don't, you know, somebody said that Jesus may have been the last Jewish carpenter. They never get into the building trades or anything like that, or you know, do that type of work. They're always, you know, middlemen, buy low, sell high, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or they get in vice.
Yep, exploiting the weakness, the concupiscence of people. And and that can, again, and they leverage that, the finance, to take to wage political, socio-political causes, you know, because they'll promote all these, like, transgenderism, homosexuality, feminism,
in
these various industries, and their media, entertainment, and even sports will promote it,
Well, see, I think it was in the 50s, Herbert Marcuse wrote a book called Polymorphous Perversity, and he said that basically heterosexuality is bad. It affects our ability to enjoy our sexual natures. So we need polymorphous perversity, which was any type of sex that's not going to lead to conception, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Sodomy, homosexuality, transgenderism, masturbation and pornography, everything except the real thing, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. You know, that's exactly, and then, you know, they had, what's the other thing they had with, see, this is all cultural Marxist.
You're the authoritarian personality,
You know, that type of stuff. If you have a normal family with your intact family with your father at home, that's a breeding ground for fascism.
Yeah, you're high on the F scale.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Right, yeah, that's that Theodore Adorno wrote those.
Yeah, whenever I see there's a school shooting or some act of mass violence and there's some misfit, and I said, well, he'd score very low in the F scale.
Well, we used to have this thing we called, we created it down at the political cesspool called the media narrative chart. If you had a white shooter and a black victim, the media narrative would be the Confederate flag or racism, okay,
mm-hmm.
as the cause. If you had a black shooter and a white victim, the media narrative would be gun control, the need for gun control.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a black shooter and a black victim, it said, forget the story, run a story about the Kardashians instead.
Yep. It's all about the narrative. So, okay. Well, Keith, thanks so much.
I enjoyed it, man. You take care.
Take care. I'll post this soon. I'll send you the link.
Yeah, just send me one on the email. I appreciate it, my friend. Thank
you. Will do. Good night, then. Thanks so much.
You're quite welcome, sir. Thank you.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, way down south of Dixie. to get in a hat.